You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Why is the music so long? Because something went wrong that day. Trust me, the song will end. The song's called Boom Clap by Charlie XCX, though, in case you want to know.
All right, let me tell you how you know something's gone wrong on the radio. That is a bumper plays for an extended period of time. Yeah, that means, like, I don't really know what's going on, but something's wrong because the stuff ain't going right. So, anyway, I think Matt's with us now. Matt, good morning.
Yeah, morning, man. This is Matt.
What the hell, man? I call you four times, you don't pick up the phone?
No shit, I'm sitting here, man, watching Fox News. It didn't ring. I don't know what's going on, man.
Really? All right. So, Matt, how do you say your last name?
It's Gospodinovich.
Gospodinovich. All right.
Yeah.
And watching Fox News. News sucks, doesn't it?
Yeah, man. I mean, it is what it is. I'm behind Trump.
Yeah, man. Good luck on that deal, man. I'm not behind either one of them, man. Hopefully the country survives whoever the hell gets elected. And then the two cops getting shot in their cars this morning.
Well, that sucks, man. I was a trooper for like 7 or 8 years after I got out of the Marine Corps, and I was a deputy sheriff for several years, so I feel for them.
Why'd you stop doing it?
Man, it just wasn't... I wasn't exciting enough, I guess, man. I don't know. It got boring.
Oh, really? And then you left there to go do what?
Well, now I'm in the casino business.
Oh, yeah. There you go. Always something going on in the casino.
There is.
Really? Is it as exciting as... because first of all, the cast of characters that hangs out in a casino, that's a different group of the population, yes?
It is, man. There's casinos all over the country now.
Yeah.
You get a lot of old people, a lot of young people. It's just always something going on. I just got bored being a cop.
So talk about, all right, so first of all, let's learn about you.
Yes.
Before we talk about Beirut. Born and raised where?
Born and raised in Biloxi, Mississippi. My dad was a shrimper. It's right on the coast. Biloxi's on the coast. I grew up working on a shrimp boat. And,
just like that Forrest Gump shit?
Pretty much, man. It's a lot like that, yeah. A little bit bigger town. It was a resort community. We're right on the beach on the Gulf of Mexico. But at that time, there's the big fishing industry. Fishing, shrimping, crabs, stuff like that.
Wow. All right. So not exactly like the movie, but, you know, not too dissimilar, right?
Not too dissimilar, no.
Okay. All right. So how does the Marine Corps get on your radar as a young kid growing up in Mississippi?
Man, it's just something I always wanted to do. I used to love John Wayne. war movies, I went in when I was, I wish I still had it, though. When I was 14, I wrote to a Marine recruiter. And just for some information, and they sent a letter back, said, we appreciate your interest in the Marine Corps, but since you're only 14, we'd like you to stay in high school and get a diploma and then come see us. And they sent me a T-shirt and a decal, I think, but I don't have the letter anymore. But that's what it did. I was, I think, a junior. When I turned 17, I went in and saw a recruiter and said, sign me up, and I delayed for almost a year, 11 months and some days before graduated and then went to boot camp.
But it was simply you watching war movies, and that's how you developed your fit. So you never considered the Army? It was just the Marine Corps?
Nah, man. I always been a Marine, I guess, even as a kid.
Wow. Well, let me tell you, and I was the same way. I think tremendously influenced by those movies. And then, I grew up in California, and then when I got down to San Diego, you know, you saw all these Marines, and they were always, they're always fit-looking guys, and, looked good in their uniform. I thought, yeah, those guys are the deal.
That was for me too, man.
Wow. All right, so you joined the Marine Corps what year?
1981.
You go to recruit training in?
Paris Island.
Paris Island. All right. And so they make a man out of you. And did you go in open contract? What were you doing?
No, I went in. I signed. I got a combat arms. And when I was in boot camp, at the end of boot camp, they sit you on a quarter deck. And, your senior reads off your MOS. I got a 0800, which is basic cannon there. Then you go to Cannoneer School, you get 0811, which is Field Artillery.
All right, so you do that, and then you get assigned to, is that when you got assigned to Charlie Battery 110?
Right. Went to Charlie 110. I remember when I walked in the squad, they'd just got back from Panama for jungle training, and, I mean, these are some rough-looking guys, man. These are just what I thought it would be. They were in the back of the squad bay cleaning the M60 machine guns and cleaning weapons and everything. And, well, who are you? Told them, well, come here, boot, and we'll show you how to clean a machine gun. So that was my first day at the battery.
You're living in the barracks, right? Living in the squad?
Right, yeah, back then. The whole time we had squad bays.
Yeah, NCO. Hey, NCOs had their curtain, right?
Well, not for a while. They
really? They didn't
have they did. They commandeered the back end of the squad bay and put a curtain there with the little corporal chevrons and sergeant chevrons hanging on. I think it was just a poncho liner, but yeah, they had it blocked off.
And that thing, but truth be told, though, that was sacred. You did not wander back there looking for shit, right?
Absolutely not.
There's sacred things in the Marine Corps, man. Once that poncho went up, you did not fuck. That might as well have been the Iron Curtain, man. You did not. You go jacking around.
Yeah. Well, especially not a boot-ass private, you know. I got pretty salty there. You know, I could go talk to him, after a couple of years. But
Not when you got there. What? Okay, all right, let's talk about that. So you get there, and what year is that? Did you get there? 1981.
That's gonna be 81. Yeah, 81.
So you get there in 81. Beirut happens in October of 83. So talk to us about your 2 years in the fleet. Was it what you expected? And how'd you
do? Yeah, man, it was great. You know, we were in the field probably at least 2 weeks out of the month, 2 or 3 weeks out of the month, doing a lot of, you know, training. When I got there, we had the 105 howitzers, which, I mean, on the breach, they had like 1943 stamp, 1944. So these were, you know, World War II era guns. But
wow. We
got real good with them. We all liked them because it's small. You can move them around real easy and everything.
Right.
But, you know, they just, you learn everything, how to take them apart. And we did a lot of field ops. We threw the Fort Bragg several times a year. You know, I've been at 29 Palms. We go to cold weather training. Just regular fleet stuff, man. Doing floats. We did NATO floats. A lot of good liberty, a lot of good times.
Let's talk about that. I've never been to the Med. I'm a Pendleton guy, so I've never been. Med floats look like something you dream about as a Marine.
The only Med I went on was to Beirut. I was on Austin. I didn't do. We did several NATO floats, but the only Med, which wasn't really a float, we got on in we got on in North Carolina and we went straight to Beirut.
Yeah, that wasn't a good one. The what's best Liberty port you were ever in?
Amsterdam.
What the hell?
Man, we got a week of Liberty in Amsterdam. We'd have formation at like 0700. You know, they'd take roll call and find out who's in jail or whatever, and first sergeant have to go get them, and then Liberty again till 07 the next day. That was a lot of fun, man.
Amsterdam. How the hell were you up in Amsterdam? That was the NATO thing?
That's where they dropped us off. I don't know. Yeah, it was the NATO. It was I think that was, it was a cold weather.
Back when we were.
It was, Norway. We have, pre-positioned, stuff up there that we have to go once a year and we take them out and clean them, shoot them. And, you know, we, train with the, whoever was, Norwegians. And that was back still during the Cold War when we were worried about Russia coming across.
Yeah, we wanted a piece of those Russians.
Well.
And that's how we were going to get it.
Right, right.
All right, all right, all right. All right. So you're doing that, and you're living life as a Lance Corporal, PSC.
Right. Yeah, man. Just having fun, man. Being a Marine, jarhead, dumbass, young, you know, full of cum jarhead.
All right, talk to us about, you guys get ready to go to Lebanon. What was the preparation like? Now you guys were going to go get in the middle of a shooting conflict. What do you remember about the preparation headed over there?
Well, man, it was pretty, we didn't have a whole lot of notice. It wasn't, I don't recall how long, maybe a couple of months. And we had just transitioned over to a new weapon system, the M198 howitzer, which is a 155, which is a lot more complicated, bigger gun, takes a bigger crew, shoots a bigger round, and it's a lot more, you know, training to do. So we've been training our asses off on them pretty much constantly for the, you know, after they swapped the guns out. So it was just more the same, you know, train, and I was excited. A lot of the guys were excited and everything, but the, you know, the NCOs, mainly staff NCOs, the officers and all were trying to calm my expectations down. You know, they said, this is a political deal, you know, gotta have a lot of discipline, self-discipline, and, you know, we probably not gonna be any shooting, probably not gonna be what you expect of it, but it turned out differently. But
right. So that's the lead up, and then you load up where do you guys load up at? Moorhead?
Moorhead City, yeah, Moorhead City. Well, we get there, and you know, it's I guess a couple weeks was on a ship, and just more of the same, more training. We did some. We had Amtrak's on the boat. He did some training, jumping Amtrak's off and on, and stuff like that. And then when we, you know, when we finally get there, I mean, they load us up on them landing boots, and we hit the beach, and then it's go time. You know, we get to our position there, which we had a fire base, which is kind of reminded me of Cape Sinai, the pictures I've seen of Cape Sinai. It's kind of on a hill,
right.
And we get in and we just dig our guns in and start fortifying the position and everything.
Well, Matt, let me stop you. The one thing that you notice, for those of us who've never been to Beirut, and you read about the Marines in Lebanon, I had no idea until I looked at it on Google Earth how small of an area that is. You guys were sitting at the airport, and it's not, what, 2 kilometers to the mountains that are looking straight down on the airport?
It's a little bit further than that, I think, but it's not much. We were right, where our ass was facing the Med, and we were facing the Shoof Mountains there.
Right.
So we were right. It's a small strip. It's a small strip there.
Yeah, I got the map out, and I was like, holy shit, man. Everything you guys did is under observation from those mountains, right?
Oh, absolutely, man. I mean, they and that's something that was strange for a guy from Artie. Because when you shoot a howitzer, you rev, you know, there's what they call direct fire when it's hit it, when it's a broken arrow type situation where you just lower the barrel and shoot straight at the enemy. But Artie, you never see where your rounds are hitting. And there were many, many missions we shot that you could actually see because we're hitting sniper positions or mortar guys or whatever in the mountains. And, you know, you could see where your rounds are hitting, which was pretty strange from an artilleryman's perspective.
From the V in the tarmac at the airport to, if you go straight west, I'm using my Google Earth, to the top of the mountains, it is 1.79 miles. What the hell? How about kilometers?
Perspective.
you're right. 2.6 kilometers to the top of that ridgeline.
Well, it seemed further from them, but that's
pretty goddamn that's pretty goddamn close though, man.
Yeah, man.
Holy shit! No, I didn't realize it. Now that's if you go due west. It looks to me, now as I zoom in on this shit, closer to that, those Shoof Mountains are like right on top of the airport. Yeah, 2 kilometers, because as towards the southern part of the runway, the mountains swing towards the runway, and
right.
So it gets a little bit closer. Then they get further as you go to the north, but
the BLT was on the other end, yeah.
Right. So, tell us when we look at if you look at a picture of the airport, where were you? Where was Charlie Battery? And what were you guys doing?
We'd be to the left. We were about 1,000 yards, maybe 1,200 yards to the left of the BLT headquarters.
Well, where the hell? Where was the BLT headquarters?
Well, that way it was airport terminal. It was Beirut International Airport Terminal.
Okay.
And they, when we got there, they turned it into the BLT headquarters. So
okay, so as I'm looking at the V in the runways, right in the center of the V.
It would be, I don't know which direction-wise, but with the end of the runway, the mountains, curve in towards the end, it would be the other end. The BLT headquarters was at the other end.
All right.
If it's still, I mean, I don't know if the
no, I'm just looking to see on a, like, I'm looking from an aerial view, and I'm looking down.
And I don't know if the airport's still there.
It's still there.
Now, if it is or not, I mean, but that's where it was positioned at that time. I don't know.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about, and so where were you guys relative to that? And what were you doing?
On the 23rd?
Yeah, on the 23rd. But did you guys rotate around? I know some of the line companies rotated.
We were the only Audi battery there.
So you stayed put.
We did patrols every day.
Right.
But our position, we did move. We did move to, closer to the beach, after the 23rd, sometime at the beginning of November, they moved the whole position, almost right on top of the airport.
Okay.
Towards the end where the mountains curve to.
Okay. To the southern end.
Yeah.
All right.
But on, like the night of the 22nd, we got, reports and, intelligence was saying that we may get hit by Syria, Syrian airstrikes. Be prepared for Syrian airstrikes. So
what?
We had to sleep. Well, that's what they that's what they told us.
Those intel guys, right? Have they ever been right?
Not that I know of.
Exactly.
It's about my pay grade, but and we even had a CI guy in our position. They had a. I'd never seen one before at the time. It was a big Chevy van, but it was four-wheel drive. It looked like a monster truck. It had big monster tires on it, and they had it painted a OD green, and, you know, they hop in and out of the van around. You wasn't allowed to talk to them. But anyway, we're supposed to get hit by Syrian jets, so we had to sleep on the gun line, which we had GP tents. Like behind our guns is where we lived, and then you know right out the door is your assigned gun, and we had to sleep on the gun line that night, and then about 6:30 in the morning is when all hell broke loose.
All right, so you're sleeping on the gun line, and how far are you from the barracks?
Like I said, about 1,200 yards.
And you're down to the south of the barrack.
Right.
Okay. I'm looking at an old image, and it looks like the terminal was kind of near the coast where you can correct
right.
me if it was it, the barracks was near the coast, next to one lane of the airport, but it wasn't inside the V, it was outside the V.
Okay.
All right. So anyway, I'm
that sounds right.
Sounds close.
Yeah, it's been a long time
wow.
Some things I never forget. Some things I'm sketchy on. But
all right, let's. I want to ask you about. So that morning, it's one of the largest explosions. Conventional explosions since World War II. Right?
Well, we were told
the largest. I've read the largest conventional explosion. Since World War II.
Right. It's like 12,000 pounds of equivalent of TNT, whatever they used.
Sorry. What were you doing when it happened?
Well, I was asleep. We were on a Sunday morning.
Wait! Hold on. I got to take a break.
Okay.
My guest is Matt. Say your last name, Matt.
Gospo Denovich.
But he's known as Gospo to his friends, right?
Gospo, yes, sir.
Right. Speaking the gospel, is that what you do? especially late at night?
Too hard to say gospel on it.
Exactly. Gospo. Anyway, Gospo joins us here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network, and we're talking about Beirut. He was a Lance Corporal at the time. He was in Charlie Battery 110, and kind of where they were, what they were doing, and anticipating Syrian airstrikes that morning. And we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll talk about the events of that day and the aftermath. So hang in there with us. As we continue a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know, listening to the interview almost a year later, one is that he reminds me of so much of what is cool about the Marine Corps. You know, guys, girls grow up all around the country, and for whatever reason, the Marine Corps gets in their head and they want to be Marines. You know, he talks about riding to a recruiter when he was a kid, and that's how he started with the Marine Corps, and then when he was old enough, he enlisted, and talking about walking into the squad bay on his first day at Camp Lejeune, and getting told get back your boot. You want to learn how to clean a machine gun, and running back there, right? And then a week of limbo in Amsterdam. How about that? I'm not sure we do that anymore, but back in the day, that's how you did it. And the best part of all of it is you had formation 07. You made sure, you know, you found out who was too drunk to go out in town. You found out who was in jail. And then you ended formation. Most everybody went back to bed and got ready for the next night. I don't know that we still do that the same way in the Marine Corps, but certainly I'd never heard of that before he said it. A week of liberty in Amsterdam. We're going to take a break. Part two of this, there's about another hour left of it, is pretty interesting stuff. If you haven't seen the aerial images of the airport and where the Marines were that day, It's really amazing, and then tomorrow you'll hear, is it tomorrow or Wednesday? It might be Wednesday you'll hear Ron Baskowski, who was a lieutenant, and he's able to talk about, you know, the relationship they had with the French army that was there, and then Ron was downtown in Beirut near the embassy, and the night of the bombing they came back after they... Obviously, after the bombing, they consolidated around the airport, and so they went through Beirut that night. So an interesting event 44 years ago. The vice president is going to speak about it today. He's going to speak here at 8th and I shortly. So on day 44 years after. October 23rd, 1983, we'll continue to talk about it. So don't touch that dial, Gospo. And also, you know, he's just that southern drawl. He's a big dude, too, and a cannoneer. And so God bless him. And, you know, he's one of the dudes that you meet in the Marine Corps and I'll tell you what, one of the things that is so intoxicating about the Marine Corps is for whatever reason, we love to be Marines. For whatever reason. And you'll hear, right, here's a kid who grows up, I believe, in Mississippi, and yet when that happens, they only know one thing. Go to whatever happened because there's Marines there. And so you'll hear that story. Here, don't touch that dial. We'll take a quick break. More of a Matt Gospodinovich coming up next.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Little country music for Gospa, but I would encourage you. There's some in the process of doing these programs and just doing the research, you know, so you can act like you're halfway intelligent when you speak to guys like Gospa about something that's incredibly important in their life. There's some pretty amazing stuff that has been preserved. There's a picture of the chaplain, of the wall of plywood, just a piece of plywood that was painted, in the chaplain's office in Beirut in the barracks. And, it says peacekeeping. There's a cross. There's a Star of David. And then there's a tablet that has the 10th commandment, the 10 commandments on it. So there's some pretty sober reminders of that day. And there's also a picture, there's several pictures of the memorial with everybody's, that's in, right at Camp Johnson, at Camp Lejeune. And so, pretty sobering stuff. And, I remember when they dedicated that. And, but it's a beautiful place now that all the vegetation has grown up around it. And, the proverbial Marine with his flat jacket on and his sleeves rolled up, steel pot on, and his M16 standing there, and the names of everybody that were lost that day on the wall. So if you've never been there, I would encourage you to, if you're ever in the vicinity, go check that out. It's very beautiful. 241 Americans were killed that day. 220 Marines and 18 sailors and 3 soldiers. So, yeah, 44 years ago today. Gospel was very cool about doing this interview. You can tell he's a good dude. And he loved being a Marine. And you certainly hear that as he talks with affection. So, I'll get out of the way. Here's the second part of that interview. And again, you'll hear more from Beirut. Eric Hamill joined us last year. He's written a book about it. And I know he was telling me it's tough for him to talk about because, you know, the situation these guys got put into and, some of the decisions that got made, he feels pretty strongly about. And told me that he doesn't think the Sun has a lot of the information concerning what happened there has yet to see the light of day. So interesting stuff. So you heard the interview that I did with him last year. Very interesting, I might add. So we continue on a day that just good Marine and artilleryman by the name of Matt Gospodinovich joined the All-Marine Radio a year ago.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Kind of creepy. I played the same bumper music.
Hump Day in the United States. Game 7 of the World Series tonight. Mike Musselman's birthday. Playing a little country music, so my boy Gospo from Mississippi relaxes.
It's the Gunner's birthday?
Exactly. Don't need him doing anything crazy on the program this morning. Because he does work at a casino, and we know what goes on in those places. All right.
The interview happens on November 2nd, I just remembered. Hence the World Series, Game 7. Hence the Gunner's birthday. But a good reminder. I'll butt out.
Gospo, I got a couple emails for you, and we'll get to those in a minute. But, talk about, before we talk about that morning, so your days in Beirut, if you were QRFing and doing infantry stuff, you were out patrolling, and then right. Did you rotate onto the gun line and have days where you were a gun bunny?
Yeah, well, we're always a gun bunny.
Okay.
We would just have, you know, the big gun crews, you know, we'd have 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 guys per gun crew. And each day, you know, the patrols rotated, the react force duty rotated. You'd have 2 or 3 guys from each gun. Today you got to go on patrol. Tomorrow you're on react, and it would just on. You know,
okay.
Rotate. If you're in the compound, you're a gun bunny. You know, if you're out the compound, you know, once you walk out the fences, then you're a gun.
All right. Talk about your day. Talk about going patrolling out in Lebanon, in Beirut. What was that like?
Man, it was, you know, it was, I enjoyed it. Everybody, you know, you want to get out of the fence. You want to get in the shit. You want to, you know, you want to see what's out there and do what we do. I mean, we had some pretty messed up, rules of engagement.
Talk to us about it because, you know, I think it's hard for Marines to believe that you guys operated under that shit. So talk to us about the rules of engagement for a Lance Corporal out on patrol.
Well, you know, inside the compound, you can't have a magazine in. Of course, you know, if we're taking fire or something, then you do what you got to do. But inside, we weren't allowed to walk around with our magazines. We had rounds in the magazines, but no magazines and weapons. And when we go on patrol, once you get outside the wire, we could put a magazine and a weapon, but you couldn't chamber around. So, you know, when you're walking and you can't chamber around, you start taking fire. If you get some raghead shooting at you with a 45, you can't open up with the 60s. You'd have to return fire in kind with a handgun or walk up. But that's the way.
That's fucking crazy, though. Did you guys think it was crazy, or did you guys ignore it?
Of course. It.
You can say it.
I never got in a firefight on patrol. Any time rounds started coming in and out, we were in a position on our fire base. I didn't. I know the guys, the grunts, in the perimeter of the airport, they were getting hit all the time. I never got in a firefight outside the wire. We returned a lot of fire from inside with the 50s and machine guns and 50s, 60s, and of course we had a lot of fire missions with our howitzers. But we even had a little card, like a little laminated card they gave you with all the rules of engagement written down on it.
Unbelievable. You had to return, like he shoots at me.
Exactly.
And I've got to shoot at him. Fucking crazy bullshit, man. That's like crazy diplomatic bullshit that you shoot at me, man, you're going to get dead, and whatever we're not going to open up to New Jersey on your ass unless you're up in the mountains fucking with us.
Well, we did, Jersey.
Yeah, man. I know.
It was awesome to see today,
they. Hey, what was that like to see?
Well, man, they were shooting right over our fucking head. It sounded like a freight train going over. Those are some big-ass guns. And, I mean, those mountains, you could literally see chunks of mountain disappearing. I mean, it was quite a sight to see.
Supposedly, that's the thing that pissed them the fuck off.
Well, I think we pissed them off a little bit, too, because we shot about 30 white phosphorus rounds one night and lit up a town, but
started on fire.
Yep, that was pretty awesome too. To see at nighttime, it was quite something. You could hear I'm not gonna say that, but yeah, it was pretty awesome to see.
All right, so. So you're patrolling, you're operating under these pretty restrictive rules of engagement, and that's daily life. And when it's October, on the day it happens, the Sunday morning it happens, how long have you been there? How long has the VLT been there?
Let's see, we got there in May, I think, beginning of May. So it was getting towards the end of our rotation. We from May to November, we were leaving in November. So it had steadily gotten worse. When we first got there, you know, nobody shot at us. There was firefights going on all the time between all the different factions. Even the LAF, we saw many times where they were having firefights amongst themselves, different outposts, because we're kind of up on a hill, and you can see right, 200 yards down the road here, they got a roadblock on the highway, road. They would check IDs or whatever the fuck they did, and then it was like the thing they called it was Lebanese armed special forces, which they ran around in tiger stripe camis, like Vietnam looking shit, and but I saw several times where they got in a firefight with themselves. They're supposed to be on the same side, you know, and, but shit started, it got progressively worse. We'd watch the firefights and then, you know, slowly, you know, a stray round would start coming my way. And then shit would be flying all the time. Towards the end, shit got bad. It got pretty bad, the closer to the 23rd it got.
All right. So was there, other than the Syrian airstrikes, were you, and there was no other indication that, that the locals were getting more combative?
Well, like I said, we never knew who, you know, I'm a Lance Corporal, they didn't tell me much. I just know, you know, they shooting at us a lot more than they used to, and, you know, we're having to, shoot back and getting these bunkers and shit. You know, that was all factionals, the Druze and the Shiites and everybody. We never really knew who's who, or we just, you know, this is out there. Where your battles between, that's your bad guys and the LAF, the Lebanese Armed Forces, they wasn't much, man. We're supposed to be there to back them up, protect them, and they even sent our battery, I don't recall if they gave them some of our guns or they brought some more howitzers in, and they took a couple guys from each crew, sent them up to the Chief Mountains, and they trained these guys. They put them through a school and everything,
right.
3, 4, 5 weeks, so they could have their own artillery support. And, you know, we trained them, you know, turned them loose. The guys come back. Their first fire mission, they shot a few rounds off, and they end up getting wiped out by counter-artillery fire. So they killed all of them guys and blew up all our guns.
Wow. Wow.
They just wasn't very well trained. I think it's not politically correct, but all the real men in Lebanese Army had been killed a long time ago, and these were just boys and people off the street, it looked like. But,
my guest, Matt Gospodinovich. Did I come close?
Yeah, that's pretty good, man.
All right, thanks. I appreciate that. All right, so we kind of painted a picture. I got an email. I'll ask you real quick. Mac, I'm listening here with fascination, listening to Matt talk about the New Jersey firing. How far off the coast would they be when they fired? Would they be relatively close? And it sounds like it would have been awesome to feel that stuff going over your head and blowing shit up.
It was kind of scary, but it was awesome, man. I mean, you could see the ships. I would imagine they were more than a couple miles offshore. That's a big ass ship, and it looked big from where I was at, and I was on, I was on shore. But it's just a roar. I mean, just a M16 round sounds like when it snaps going over your head. These things were. You know, it was like,
holy shit. But you could see the mountains being rearranged when they impacted.
Absolutely, man.
Wow.
Absolutely. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about that morning. So it's Sunday morning, and, what were you doing, and, you know, what were you going to do that day? What was the plan?
Like I said, Sunday's usually a down day. You know, everybody's got their own, you know, everybody's got duty, but, you know, if you don't have duty, Sunday's a down day. But, like I said, we were on alert that night, stayed up all night, then they said, all right, just shut it, you know, just everybody sleep on the gun lines. We gotta be ready for whatever happens. And then, it was like 6:30 in the morning. I was actually just sleeping on a poncho liner next to the ammo pit. And it's when it went off, when an explosion went off, it seemed like it lasted forever. I mean, it's a noise that it can't be described. I mean, it's like I don't know if you've been in a thunderstorm or something. Lightning hits right outside your window, and it booms, and everything shakes. Well, it's like that times a thousand. I mean, you could feel it. The ground shook like an earthquake, and it just continued to roar, roar, called to explain, and I thought these fucking guys are dropping bombs on us. I thought it was like a jet, like a Harrier. I know Harriers scream when they come over. That's what I was thinking in my mind. That's a jet screaming over, and they're dropping shit on us.
Right.
But then it kind of, you know, dust went everywhere. Flew, knocked people out of Iraq. Some guys were sleeping on cots. I was just on the ground. But, you know, and then you jump up and look around. Well, the BLT headquarters building, I mean, you could see it from my position perfectly. It was part of the skyline. It was like a six-story building. This was a big building. And, you know, we looked over there, and it's just a big, giant mushroom cloud, like Hiroshima. It literally was a mushroom cloud, like a nuke, you know. And, I mean, it took a minute or so for everybody to go, what the fuck's going on, which, you know, so I wasn't even on React Force that day. But I grabbed my shit, and I ran to the Amtrak, and they were loading up, getting ready to go. And I told Lieutenant Kelly, was our platoon commander, I said, look, I'll tell you if anybody, you know, let me get in here. He's got to know we're full. Everybody, you know, are you on a React Force? I said, no. And he had been hearing the radio traffic from the BLT. And he said, and, you know, anybody don't want to go, you can get off now. Gospel, jump on. Nobody's going to say nothing. It's pretty bad over there. And somebody got out.
No shit?
Yeah. And I got in. Tailgate comes up. And we go
wait a minute. So there's no doubt Gospel was going though, right?
Well, man, I wanted to go, man. I mean, that's just, you know, that's why I joined the Marine Corps to you know, be a Marine. That's what we do.
All right, let me ask you a question about the dude that got out. Is he still around?
I don't even recall who it was. You know, it was just somebody didn't want to go. I mean, I really don't. And nothing was said ever again. I don't, you know, I don't think when I got back I knew who it was. At the time, I even paid attention to who got out.
Right.
You know,
no, it's just, hey, when Marines need help, Marines don't say, yeah, not me today. You know, normally, my experience,
in
combat, you yell help, motherfuckers come, and they don't, right. It doesn't matter. Like, just like you got that truck. Like, I don't know what's over there. I don't know what I'm going to find, but I'll tell you what, if there's Marines there and they need my help, I'm all in.
I don't know, and I thought about telling that story, not whether I should, but if that's what I...
No, I see. You know what? This is the great thing about All Marine Radio Gospel. We talk about the truth, what's real, and because we all deal with it, and it ain't easy. But it's I think it's a place where we come to you know, to be honest and candid and share our emotions with each other. You get in the truck and go over there, describe what you found.
Right. Well, like I said, it's an Amtrak, man. You know, it's closed in, the gate comes up, the back gate comes up, and we hauling ass over there. And you can hear the radio going, I fucking hate shit, man. I mean, people screaming and cursing and what the fuck, and so it's a very short trip over there, and I got my mind.
Gospel, and that's not how the radio is most of the time, all the time.
No,
right?
No, absolutely. No.
The radio is very orderly, right? And now,
exactly.
Now it's gone cuckoo.
People just, you know, it's freaking out, and I got my mind what the BLT looks like, which gonna, you know, when his tailgate comes down, we'll just, you know, something's gonna be bad, but, we get there, and it was like a movie, man. It's slow motion. I can hear the hydraulics on a tailgate of that Amtrak going down slowly. And it's just like another world. When it hit me like a ton of bricks in the face, like, what the fuck, that's not what I thought I was gonna see. It's just, complete devastation, a big pile of just rubble where the BLT was. I mean, I could say BLT, that was our headquarters building. That was a big, huge building, and it's just gone. And there's dead bodies, there's hurt people, guys running around with arms cut off, and, you know, it's just unbelievable, you know, and I'm ready to jump out, and everybody just stopped and looked for, I mean, you know, for like 10 seconds, and then you know, it kicks in, and you get out there, and, it's a clusterfuck. Everybody's dead. There's no command and control.
Right.
This is where, you know, all the brass was. All we got, we got Lieutenant Kelly, he's on the track here, and he's, you know, y'all stay put, let me find out what's going on, and, I mean, we didn't. Everybody just spread out and started doing what they could. You started digging through the rubble and helping who you could. I saw some survivors, some guys that were still alive on the outside, but once we started digging, I never found a live person after that. I mean, it was me and Mark Riley and Arthur Linquito, another couple Lance Corporals with me, and Art was a small guy, small frame guy, and he would like climb through holes, you know, in a rubble and shit. He'd say, "Hey guys, I found a guy down here, but he's dead," you know. So me and Mark would go, you know, just pull the rocks and the rubble off until we get him, and had an area where they were putting the bodies, and we'd drag him over there. And man, it was a long day, man.
So the building's essentially pancaked, and you guys are working around the edge of the building, and
all over climbing up. I mean, okay. just the fucking truck made a crater. I mean, it had to be like 20 foot deep and 30 foot across all the way around. Where he drove right through the front doors of the place,
right?
Before he kicked it off. So I mean, it was a perfect hit. You know, they were finding shit miles away that had blown way up in the air, and the vehicles and shit a mile away. That just those little jeeps went dead back then,
right.
You know. And but we, I mean, we were there about 16 hours, I think, before we finally got relieved. They started bringing guys in off the ships that were offshore to relieve us because. You know, we knew a lot of these guys. I found a guy from a battery, Dennis Thompson. He had been there for mess duty, but we found him, his body. You know, so a lot of guys. You know, it takes a toll on you eventually.
Let me just hit pause there on the events of that day and ask you and ask a personal question. Everybody deals with their own shit. Whether you're a Vietnam guy, an Iraq guy, an Afghanistan guy, or some combination thereof, Korea, World War II, and I've talked with guys from all those conflicts. That stuff is burned into your brain forever. The smells of the day, the sounds of the day, the sights of the day. How have you dealt with that, Gospel? I mean, we didn't have PTSD back then, you know. You came home and you were supposed to deal with your shit.
Exactly. And I didn't deal with it for a long time. And it's not till, I guess, social media, Facebook, since I started getting on Facebook 6, 7, 8 years ago, and started connecting with guys from Charlie Batter, guys from the BLT that I was with.
Okay.
I almost, you know, it was like a dream. Nobody knew, you know, we're starting to get more awareness now.
Right.
But back then, nobody, you know, when I came home on leave afterwards, you know, I just in high school a couple of years ago, I'd be with my guys, "What you been up to?" I was like, "Well, I was in Beirut." "Well, where's that?" Nobody knew what the fuck you was talking about and didn't really care, you know. So you internalize shit. I mean, it in fact, me, I'm cold. I don't, you know, I've been married several times and divorced several times, and it's because I, you know, just the way I've dealt with it. But I have, I've been going to the VA, and they're taking care of me.
They are. How's your experience with the VA, good or bad?
I tell you, you know, I've had nothing but good experience. The Biloxi VA, it's right here in town. I don't have to travel far. I've had I've had good experience with them.
Okay. No, you know, let me just tell you, I think the more guys you talk to, You know, the VA, like every other organization, is dependent upon their people. And in,
exactly.
And in some places, they have good people doing good work, and they have, and they do a lot of great work. And then there's other places that they struggle. So, we don't pay.
Yes, I've read all the horror stories and I've seen it, and it's terrible what, you know, how some veterans are treated. And I went in totally expecting, you know, to have to fight, you know, to do battle. But, I had nothing but a good experience with the Biloxi VA here, man. So I'm lucky.
Right. Okay. All right. I wanna release the pause button. Now on that day, so you get relieved after you said what about 16 hours of being at the headquarters?
Right, it was dark by the time. I mean, it was, you know, 6-7 in the morning when I got there, and it was dark by the time we finally got relieved, and it was still for days. It was a clusterfuck because nobody, there wasn't, you know, there was just any, you know. I don't know who was in charge. I don't know why they, you know, they had, it took them, and some of the guys that survived, they didn't know where the fuck they was for weeks because they had, you had Red Crescent ambulances from all over picking up a guy that's alive, putting an ambulance, and just taking him. Nobody knew he was there, gone, whatever, and you know, you were hearing, all right, well, so-and-so was in a fucking hospital 20 miles down the road. You know, he just come back, you know, so it was,
wow.
it was, you know, but anyway, we finally got relieved. I remember, getting back to the fire base, and, I had to go on, I had to pull a duty on a bunker. And me and it's my best buddy in the Marine Corps, Mark Riley. He was right there with me the whole time. And we're just sitting there. And I think that's when the adrenaline finally wore off and it just, everything started, you know, coming down on me. And I mean, you know, I'd never been claustrophobic or anything before, but being in that, you know, seeing what had happened and I'm sitting in this little bunker, I mean, you know, I kind of had a panic. Tag of time, I started shaking a little bit and getting nervous. And I remember Gunny Quick, Battery Gunny, had come. He was doing rounds, and he told us. He said, "Gospel, Riley, I want to tell y'all, y'all did a great job today. Everybody down there noticed what y'all did, and you're the best guys I had." And you know, he said, "You need to tighten up, Gospel. Don't lose it now. You know, bear that shit. You're a Marine, and you know, keep doing what you're doing, man." So, and I guess that's what I did. I just buried the shit for a lot of years.
Well, you know what? And that's what the Vietnam guys did. I remember talking to my therapist.
Well, Donnie was a dark green Vietnam vet. We loved him, man. I'd follow that man to hell and back. He's a, you know, best staff NCO I've ever served on him. He's a good guy.
And what did he tell you about it?
Well, you know, I said, "Gunny, that shit was terrible. I never seen nothing like that." And he said, "Guys, bow luck. I did 3 tours of 9, and I never seen nothing like that shit neither, man. Just, you know, y'all did a good job."
And that was it?
Yeah, that was it. And then, you know, the next day, you just keep on keeping on.
Right, right. No, it's amazing because, you know, I was talking to a therapist, and I said, "What do you talk to those guys after all these years?" And he looked at me, and he said, "The same thing I talked to you about." And I said, "After all these years?" And he looked at me and said, "Mac, they've never fucking dealt with it. They came home and stuffed it in the jack-in-the-box, shut the lid, and didn't go near the fucking hand crank, man." And I said,
"Exactly. And that's what I did. I took, you know, I withdrew. Whenever, you know, I never could get close to anybody or show any emotions or anything. I'm, you know, everybody at Gospel, you'd always say, well, Gospel's cool. Well, I just never, you know, I was opposite of bipolar. I never got mad. I never got happy. I never got nothing. I just, you know, because I'm afraid I'd finish having that panic attack I had in that bunker,
right.
You know, when I was 19, 20 years old. That was some horrific shit for a teenage kid to see, you know, when I didn't, eventually, after many failed marriages, you know, I started listening to what my family was saying. It's like, man, you need to go do something. You're not all, you know, you need to do something.
You're not all right in the head?
Well, you know, I thought I was, you know, the guy at the VA, so I told him, you know, well, I thought I was John Wayne, you know, that's why it took me so long to ask for help. And he said, well, John Wayne was a fucking actor, man. And I'm like, well, okay.
Yeah, Gospel, I don't know if you know this, but, yeah, that John Wayne was never in the Marine Corps.
I know, man.
You know that?
That's good. Yeah.
He never fucking served a day in his goddamn life. I know, but I know, but it looked cool as shit.
Yeah, you gotta love it.
John goddamn Wayne. I've got a couple emails for you. Mac, wow, the last corporate perspective of that day, pretty gruesome. First of all, as a fellow Marine, tell Gospo, God love him, man. Lance Corporal is the backbone of the Marine Corps, getting into that building, looking for people that are alive and pulling out the dead ones. That's the Lord's work, and can't say thanks enough for the Lance Corporal that went and did that day. And we're certainly proud of him and just hope he knows that today. So, Gospel, the little love coming your way.
All right, well, thank you, man. Super fine. That means a lot.
Question for him. How soon did things get somewhat back to normal in terms of a routine, or did he stay on that pile of rubble for a while and work it, or did he head back to the guns?
Well, like I said, it was I was there about 16 hours, and then we went back to the gun line, and they had replaced, you know, by the next day, everybody, all the recovery and the people at Ground Zero there, were another, they called the air alert force in from somewhere. They had, you know, they had Marines offshore that had been offshore, but they, I'd been back there. I went back there, but not, you know, not for, recovery or doing any, you know, digging for bodies and stuff. They had,
they brought another guy.
Yeah, they brought in other guys for that, yeah.
Okay, all right. And so you went back to your former employment,
right,
of patrolling,
right,
and being on the guns. All right.
Yes.
Another email. Hey, Mac, awesome interview with Gospo. Loving learning more about Beirut. Also, Lance Corporal's perspective, always very cool. Question for him. I heard his comment about social media and reconnecting with his guys. Could you talk about that a little bit? Has that helped him being around his friends? Do they ever get together? So, Gospel, those guys that you were around that you mentioned, tighter than tight, yeah? Do you ever get together with them?
Man, I have, like I said, it has been a great help because before the social media, before Facebook, you know, you'd have I had a couple numbers of guys that I'd stay in touch with semi-regularly. But, now, you know, we have there's a Beirut veteran site. There's a Charlie Battery site. There's a new Charlie Battery site for the guys from, Desert Storm all the way up to now that's been in combat and everything, which is, it's cool to look at. You know, these are young kids, but it's still fucking Charlie, man. It's the same. Charging Charlie and everything, but I've dozens of guys now that are in a unit, and we stay in touch on Facebook almost daily. I did go; they have the Beirut Memorial in Jacksonville,
right.
And I made a trip. It's getting on 10, 12, 13 years ago now with a couple guys, and that was really before. That's just through phone. Phone calls and stuff. That's before the social media thing. So and now, for some reason, man, I want to go, but I'm not yet ready to go and see everybody and be at that wall. I can't explain it. I don't know. I talk to them on the phone. I see them, but I don't know. I just don't know. There's something still holding me back.
Go.
From going. But they do. They have a.
No, listen. Hey, listen to me. Go.
I want to, man.
No, don't say another word. Just fucking go.
All right, Mike, I will, man.
All right, let me tell you why. there is no warmer place on the planet than being with your battle buddy. None. You know what I mean? And I've been to Iraq twice and Afghanistan once. And I don't care how long it's been since I've seen them. You walk through the door, you see them, and you know, you start with their nicknames, and all you do is, "What's up, motherfucker?" And it is the coolest. You sit down with a drink and you laugh, and they're your boys, man, forever. Forever.
I'm going next year. I'm going there.
Yeah, you got to. Mark it down and go, and let me just tell you, I know October 23rd's got to be a brutal day for you every year, but being in their company, man, would be the best. I promise you.
Well, I'm going to make the trip again, man. I'm going to make it this next year. I'm going on the 23rd. I sure will.
All right, another email. Hey, Mac, where's Gospel working? What casino? Maybe I'll bump into him. Where are you working, man?
Golden Nugget Casino in Biloxi, Mississippi, man. Come see me.
The Golden Nugget Casino in Biloxi, Mississippi. What do you do at the casino?
I'm a dealer, man. I deal cards, roulette, blackjack.
Really?
Yeah.
Can you give us any?
He's working for a living, man.
Can you give us any advice on that? Is that the?
Don't play. Don't do nothing. You can't win. It's like going to movies, man. It's entertainment. You're never gonna get your $12 back for the ticket. So just enjoy the show, you know.
Okay, so you're going there to have a good time. But
yeah,
but are you kidding me? There's so many dudes, and I'm not a gambler, but I hear them. Oh no, here's my system, and blah 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 blah. And I get here. Go ahead. What?
There's no systems. Thing, man, blackjack maybe. You count cards a little bit, but it's still joints got you behind an 8-ball when you walk in the door, which is kind of funny, man. When you know. Muncie's always been a gambling town, even before they had legal casinos. They had backroom joints and everything, and so I grew up around it. And when I get to the fleet, man, I mean, in Beirut, in opposition, they had a tent that had a crack game going, or a blackjack, poker going, just about 24/7. Staff NCOs and everything from all around the BLT would come to our position, and they'd go up to the tent and gamble. So it's kind of like I'm still doing what I was doing, man.
Let me just tell you. Now, I don't know. That stuff still goes on, and it should, because there's great camaraderie in those, in those card games, and then even if the guys who are just hanging out in there laughing and having a good time, that's normally a pretty good time. I got a text message question for you. Mac, asking about falling between a 20-foot snowdrift and a gun shed in Norway in 1984. Talk to me.
Well, yeah, man, that's Sergeant Major Post. Is that Sergeant Major Post or Gunny Smith? One of them. We were in Norway on, I think it had to be that when we had that Liberty, that was that same float. But
that you were in Amsterdam?
Yeah, well, it was that same float, but we were in cold weather training in Norway, and I'm walking next to it. We're all walking next to a damn GP tent, and I mean, I fell in, and I screamed like a little girl, and I'm pretty sure it was Post that grabbed me and kept me from falling in.
You screamed like a bitch?
Yeah, I did, man. I'm sorry. I'm man enough to admit I screamed like a bitch. I don't know when I thought I was going down a crevasse or something, because it was just snow, but I did. He grabbed me and pulled my ass out. Who was that from?
No, I'm not telling you, man. I can't reveal my sources. We're doing a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio here on the All Warrior Radio Network, and we're talking to Matt Gaspo, and he's a Marine in Lance Corporal. How many times did you make Lance Corporal?
At least a couple, man.
All right. Made Lance Corporal a couple times. And was part of the QRF on the morning of October 23rd, 1983, Charlie Battery, that headed over to the BLT, headquarters that was destroyed that morning. Hey, Mac, I got another email. Mac, when Gaskell looks back on it, is there any lesson learned from that that he thinks about? Does it piss him off, the situation they got put into, the loss of life, and how has he dealt with that? So would he tell Marines now, would he give them any advice?
Man, we Marines, you know, just go do your job. You know, go out and kill the fucking bad guys when they let you, and be a Marine, man. We, you know, everybody that's a Marine knows what that means. You know, that's way above my pay grade. Should we have been there? Who the fuck knows, man? I go where they send me. You know, I would have done things differently, but, you know, sometimes the diplomacy works, but, you know, I think we should have stayed. I don't think we should have pulled out when we did. But, again, man, that ain't my call, you know.
Well, you know what? A lot of guys go through that, though. The Vietnam guys, they feel that, hey, man, we lost 58,000 motherfuckers there, and we pulled the fuck out and said, yeah, you know, our bad, didn't work out. And then you guys in Lebanon, the guys in Somalia, they're pissed about they're pissed, and then and now we're doing the same shit in Iraq and Afghanistan. We go there, we fight.
Just don't tie our hands, man. If you're gonna send the Marine Corps in, release the hounds, take our handcuffs off, and let us go do what we do. And I promise you, it will be over quickly, and we can get the fuck out.
Well, you know,
no matter where it's at.
But here's the problem, Matt, is that we can't get the fuck out, because when you knock over some shit like this, you got, you know, in the American, you know, pottery barn, you break it, you own it, and then we're not leaving right away. And then the American people get tired of it, and they say, oh, we need to leave. Well, then why the fuck did you send us in the first place if you weren't ready to stay here? Just like you guys leaving Lebanon. If this wasn't worth doing, then why the fuck did you send us? And now that we got our nose bloodied, we're going to leave like bitches? Fuck that.
I'm with you, man.
So, no, I think a lot of guys share that frustration. It's like, look, you know, we'll do our shit, right? But don't waste the effort. And I think that's the major frustration I hear. And guys say, yeah, I've learned to live with it, but it's bullshit. In my opinion, it's bullshit. There's some leaders in this country, both general officers and politicians, man. You shouldn't be able to do that shit and just walk away from it and write a book.
Yeah.
If you fuck it up, you got to go on Devil's Island, someplace out in the Pacific, with Amelia Earhart's bones.
Yeah.
That's my view anyway. But Gospel, if you had to, I do this little segment, and I'm going to ask you this question. If you were to, if I have two sons, one's a lieutenant in 3-5, and one's a captain who's now a teacher at the basic school. If they were going to war, and I said, hey, Gospel, talk to my kids, give them one piece of advice about going to war, fighting for their country. What advice would you give them, based on your experience?
As officers, lead from the front, man. You enlisted guys, they notice that shit. They know who's bullshit and who ain't, and who, you know, who's a good officer, who's not. You know, lead by example. Don't do nothing, show them, you know, don't ask them to do nothing you wouldn't do, and that's the best thing, you know, just be a good officer, man, lead from the front.
All right, Gospel, is there anything else that we should know about Beirut that I have not asked you, haven't been smart enough to ask you, that you want people to know?
No, man. I mean, we covered everything. It was, you know, the guys, you know, we're proud of what we did, you know, and just never forget. That's the motto for BLT-18 and 241. That's the body count. You know, just never forget on October 23rd. You know, that's the, you know, more Marines were killed than any time since World War II. At one pop, it was just say a toast, man. Simplify until Valhalla. You know?
All right. Gospel, you don't mind if I give you a call and bring you back on in case we do a gambling segment, do you?
Man, I'm here for you, man. I'm good at that. I can give you some life.
All right. My mom, the first time I went up, when I didn't know that I was of age, but I grew up in Sacramento, which is about 90 minutes from Tahoe.
Yeah.
So go up there and go to a concert and did a little gambling afterward. So I got home late, and next morning my mom's asking me, did you have fun? I said, yeah, it was awesome. She said, that hotel's beautiful, isn't it? I think Harris had built a new one or something. I said, yeah, that's crazy. She said, who do you think pays for that? And I said, I don't know, like Harris does. She looks at me, she said, no. I said, who? She looks at me and she says, suckers like you.
That's the truth, man.
I said, my mom in our kitchen. I said, what? She said, look at all those buildings, man. Look at Vegas. Look at Reno. Guess what pays for all of it? The money of fools. And I was like, damn, mom. No, didn't need to go gangster on my ass. But you know what? I know, yes, she was. But you know what? It made sense to me. And I've never, and I had, you know, and I get called, like, I have friends who have their systems and shit like that. Oh, you know, roulette, it's math. All you got to do is do this. I'm like, yeah, look at, Vegas tells me that it ain't math. It might be math, but it ain't good math, man. It's bad math, but.
I just said, man, it's just entertainment. You can get, you know, most people can go in and have a good time. You know, there are some people that have a problem with it, but fuck, you got drunks and drug addicts and everything else that can't handle, you know, anything in moderation. So, you know, I still enjoy it a little bit, not like I used to, but I've learned a lesson over the years.
All right. Gospel, anything you want to say to your friends that are listening?
Just simple fun, brothers. Charlie, man. I'll see y'all in Jacksonville on the 23rd next year.
All right, man. All right, and next year, after you go to Jacksonville, you shoot me a message, and I want to have you back on. I want to get your thoughts on going there. I happened to be going to school. I was an infantry officer. They augmented me to the Marine Corps, and then they told me I had to become a supply officer. And so then I said, oh, I quit. I'm not doing that. And I, but they made me go to school. So I was going to school at Camp Johnston when they built that memorial. And I used to run by it, and I used to stop and look at those guys and, you know, and that, you know, the words on that monument, you know, they came in peace.
They came in peace, right?
Yeah. No, it's beautiful. But the more important thing than the monument is you being amongst the warriors of our tribe,
yeah.
Man. And, you know, it's the best. It's the best. So, anyway, I want to thank you for doing this, man. I appreciate it.
Well, thanks for having me, Mike. I really enjoyed it, man. It's kind of therapeutic. I really enjoyed it.
Well, no, let me, I'll just tell you this, what's one of the coolest things about All Marine Radio, other than we can say fuck on the radio, is, and if you can't tell, I like that part of it.
Cool.
Exactly. It's us in our own language. But no, it's guys listening to this from different conflicts. And now they're hearing a guy from Lebanon, Beirut, that went through the same shit that they went through, maybe worse. And then if that guy is doing all right, then, you know, then I should go get help, too. And the goal of all of this is, we don't really talk about it much, is tricking their fucking asses in, don't kill your, don't fucking do it.
No, man.
If you go to that black place, don't fucking kill yourself. Cover down behind us. We'll get you to a better place like we always have.
Just talk to somebody, man. There's hotlines. I had to call a hotline myself that really got me going. To get in there, man, and just talk to somebody. Talk to somebody.
And so when people hear you say that, like, fuck, this dude was in that building, and that's the most Marines, you know, like you said, that have been killed at one time since World War II. And maybe, I mean, you know, maybe ever in terms of one, you know.
Right, one.
One attack. That have ever been killed in the history of the Marine Corps. And this guy is in the building pulling people out of it, pulling bodies out of it, some of them guys he knows. And if he can do it, well, fuck, I can do it too. And that's the message we want. It's a message of hope. And don't make us go to another fucking funeral, man. Do not do that shit. So, anyway.
Absolutely, man.
All right. All right. God bless you, man.
All right, man. Simplify, man. Thanks for having me, bro.
Simplify. Our paths will cross one day.
I hope so, man.
And you can buy me something to eat.
Sure, man. Come on down. I'll get you a cup.
No, I don't want that shit. Hey, what's up? Listen to
you.
I got
you, man.
I'll get you a comp at the Golden Nugget.
I'll pour you some shrimp, man. How's that?
If I come down there, what do we eat in Mississippi? Shrimp?
Man, shrimp, crabs, crawfish. I mean, we got everything.
What's your favorite?
I love them all, man. Crawfish, you know, just a cold beer, some hot crawfish are good, or boar shrimp, you know. Corn on the cob and potatoes boiled up. Those are good.
All right. All right. What's Mississippi's signature dish?
Well, man, you know, the coast is a little different. You know, probably barbecue up north. The coast, it's got a lot of New Orleans influence and Mobile. It's a little bit different than the rest of Mississippi. Biloxi is more like a Florida, coastal beach town. There's 26 miles of beach, runs across the whole Biloxi coast. So it's more of a resort town. We got a lot of influences, the French, Cajun, and Italian, and we've got a big Asian Vietnamese population here.
And so what? The northern part of Mississippi is more tilted towards Tennessee?
Yeah.
Barbecue?
Rural type stuff. Fried chicken and, a lot of soul food.
Right.
You know, turnip greens and red beans and rice, and it's just it's a big, big, huge melting pot down there.
All right, and then on the coast, more of the New Orleans, the Narlans.
New Orleans, Cajun style stuff, Acadian they call it.
All right, Matt, first of all, I want to thank you very much, and on behalf of everybody listening and all your Marine buddies here at All Marine Radio, thank you very much for doing it. God bless you, man. Hang in there, and we'll do this again.
I'd love to. All right. Thanks, Matt.
All right, bud. Take care. There you have it. Lance Corporal on multiple occasions. Matt Gospodinovich, right, being part of a QRF, that they were, you know, I mean, it's crazy how fate lines you up, you know, that you come from, he comes from Mississippi, and he winds up there, and, that morning, so, crazy stuff, you know, I was actually looking at the barracks. And if you look at it from Google, I think you can see where the barracks was, and it wasn't the terminal, it was down the road from the terminal. But I'm not exactly sure, because there's still, it looks like the imprint of a building. So, anyway, I'd be curious, because I can't find an aerial image of it. All the shots you see of it are from the ground, which make it difficult if you Google it. It's on the corner of a building, and it looks like you can see the coastal portion of a runway in the distance. So there's the coast, there's a strip of houses, there's a runway, and then there's buildings, there's another road, which I believe leads down to the airport itself, and it's just not easy to, I'm trying to put it all together, and not easy to do, because there's not one wide shot of it. But anyway. So looking for it on Google, it's a little bit problematic. So if anybody does have a wider shot that makes more sense, send it to me. You can send it to live.allmarineradio@gmail.com. But, want to thank, Gospo for, coming on. and Denny Smith for setting that up. Very, very cool stuff. And as he said, therapeutic for him in a way. To you know, talking about it. But again, it allows us to highlight, you know, All Marine Radio and what it is and what we want. And more than anything, what we want is when you go to a dark place, when you feel that, don't go there. Do not go there. Pick up the phone, get in touch with your friends, all of that. So, we continue. We're going to take a quick break as we continue here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network. And when we come back, we're going to we're going to stand outside of the country, actually. And we're going to talk about what it is to fly in a... I got an email from Dave. I'll buy him a drink next year. And, boys listening out there. And, that's awesome. But, a lot of guys stay away from, for whatever reason, they stay away from reunions. Don't want to go there. Don't want to open Pandora's box. And if you're one of those guys, get over it. Just stuff it in the closet because, as I said, there's no cooler place that you ever go to than, and I hope you can feel it between the discussions that you hear from Mike Musselman and I. You know, we've deployed 3 times together. You know, all of my deployments, Mike has been there. We didn't always deploy together, but we were there together. And we became friends, and, you know, I thought he was funny the first time I met him. Like, who is that dude, man? He's funny. So, anyways, we're going to take a quick break. We come back. Matt Creighton's going to join us. He's a 53 pilot. The Marine Corps had a mid-air collision. The investigation completed recently, and so it's in the news. So I wanted to do what we do with the F-18 community when we have mishaps, or what we've done with the F-18 community when we have mishaps is, you know, bring pilots on and talk about, you know, how they do what they do. And gives us some idea of the complexity and then how things do go wrong. So anyway, we're gonna do that. Dan Creighton gonna join us. He from Pennsylvania State University as we continue.
It's interesting to listen to that after a year. Especially the part of, how there was no mental health We didn't do mental health in the Marine Corps. You just dealt with your shit, like everybody did. But I find it really interesting, the way Marines tried to help each other. You know, Gospel talks about his company, his battery gunny, checking on him, and because he knew what was coming. 3 combat tours in Vietnam, he knew what was coming that night, and told him, hey man, you got to hold your shit together. And then I thought it was really cool when Gospo said to him, Gunny, I never seen anything like that before in my life. And then his Gunny looks at him and says, Gospo, I have 3 combat tours of Vietnam. I never seen anything like that either. And so to me, there's this very, very cool oral tradition of mental health in the Marine Corps that did the best that it could to help explain to guys what they were going to deal with and how you were going to deal with it. And again, the way most guys dealt with it is just not put it there and don't go there. It's not healthy. And so, really interesting. I'm going to have to get, not today, but Gospel on and find out, A, if he went. If he didn't, he's gonna get booted in the ass, or at least we'll talk about it, and then see how he's doing. Check in with him. I need to go down. I need to when I go see the gunner, we'll head over to Mississippi. Go see Gospel. Get a comp meal at the Golden Nugget. How funny was that? All right, we'll take a quick break. Mike Musselman gonna join us next here on a Monday edition on a day when we remember the service and sacrifice of 241 Marines, sailors, and soldiers that were killed that day in Beirut, part of BLT-18, part of the 24th MAU at the time, the Marine Amphibious Unit. And MAU sounds so normal now, but it didn't. You know, we were MAUs at the time. And, you know, they went there to the Beirut International Airport, and then they deployed out of their companies in different parts of the cities, protecting things, and got put into a very difficult situation. But honestly, it was the beginning of our involvement with Hezbollah, who we have danced with now for low 50 years. So, mindful of that, mindful of the sacrifice of those families, October 23rd, a sober day in the Marine Corps. So, don't touch that dial. More Ball Marine Radio coming up next. My guest this morning, Ron Baskowski, Brigadier General, retired United States Marine Corps. We're talking about his time in Beirut. And, Ron, let me ask you, did you, so you guys go in there, and essentially you're a peacekeeping piece, and you're embedded with the French as a liaison officer. Did you notice the tension, and did the tension change when I believe it was it the New Jersey that was shooting off the coast when they started shooting in support of the Lebanese army? Did you notice, because a lot of people will point to that and the deadly fire from the United States, you know, if you can imagine a United States Navy battleship out there booming off the coast. Was there anything that you guys detected in terms of, hey, something's wrong here?
Yeah, there definitely was a shift. One of the things that the French had a totally different concept of deployment. Because of their experience in Algiers and because of the city, their concept of deployment was to more of a traditional counterinsurgency type deployments. They would have squads out and living in buildings with families. They lived among the populace. They lived throughout the city. So you could really see that. You could see it clearly, you know, that they had a different concept where the U.S., we had a centralized location down the airport, and we would patrol out from there. The French lived, and they patrolled between posts, and so they were, I think, in greater tune with the populace. But the populace in the northern part of the city, especially on the east, they told the French what they wanted to hear, I think, as well. But what we started noticing was, there was an increase of direct fire and then indirect fire. We noticed that so much so that towards the end of August and in September, we started getting indirect fire, and Lieutenant George Losey and Sergeant Ortega of Alpha Company were hit by killed by mortar fire. So now I've been the XO for Alpha Company, and with only lost Colonel Losey, they're down two officers. So I returned to the airport, and you could at different points in the airport you could see what was going on. Like you could. From the center sector where we were, where Alpha Company was, when I went back, you could look up into the Shoot Mountains and you could see valleys that ran east to west, and we could see the artillery shooting, and we were just itching to shoot back. In fact, we cheered when we heard naval gunfire going off, and we were just itching to shoot with our mortars and artillery. The response is, who wants to be shot at and be sitting ducks down there on the low ground?
Mm-hmm.
Nobody. So it was a huge boost for morale when we started shooting. But again, that goes back to what I said about the principles of peacekeeping. We had no idea of how this would be perceived as being neutral. Or not being neutral. We are part of the enemy now.
And that kind of happens, and it really goes unnoticed by us. Let me ask you, I had Phil Smith on last week, and he said when he got there with 2-8, one of the first things that struck him was the proximity of the Chute Mountains to the airport. He said, they're right on top of you. And he said, I don't know why it didn't, hit me in the head.
sooner. But when he said when we showed up off the coast of Beirut, and then he said we did an amphibious landing. When we got there, you look up and the Sheep Mountains just dominate the airport. He said it was pretty daunting. It was pretty daunting to be there.
No, that's correct. I agree. It was, they were right there. It's like California. You know, you come in just off of the shore and there are the mountains right backing up. And you could see up into the Sheep at different points. You couldn't see the Pecan Valley.
Right.
But we hear in Pecan Valley, and we knew all sorts of stuff was going on out there.
3 kilometers is the distance between probably the center of the airport and the mountains of the Sheep Mountain. I mean, you realize, you kind of look at the map, and you're like, oh, wow, that's pretty close. Then you measure it in 3 clicks. Are you kidding me?
Yeah. I mean, it was even closer at the southern end of the airport. Because the mountains closed down
right.
to the coast.
Yeah.
And we're in 50-cal range.
Yeah, it's like 2 clicks at the southern end. Like, you got to be kidding me. I've got Google Earth out. It's just, when he said that, I got on Google Earth, and yeah, it's like barely 2 clicks at the southern end. Holy smokes. And I think, you know, as we look back on Lebanon, you know, until you revisit it, you know, and then you guys are in the midst of all of that. And then all of a sudden, as you guys begin to defend yourself, you guys, unbeknownst to you, the Tide kind of opinion about us as peacekeepers changes, correct?
That's correct.
All right. Talk to us about, so much was made in the aftermath of the barracks bombing, of the rules of engagement there. It, you know, we've all learned that, you know, just something we live with. Rules of engagement. Talk to us about the rules of engagement. Did you guys roll around with magazines and weapons? Were you trying to be peacekeepers in this violent? I mean, you're taking Marines killed in action, right? And how did you guys roll around on a daily basis? And what were the rules of engagement?
Well, we did a lot of drilling on the rules of engagement and weapons conditions. We did a lot of things like that. But I think the rules of engagement were confusing because I think the reason why the rules of engagement were confusing is because you had 2 sets. One when you're under fire and one when you're not under fire. And you had two different cards. I you had a white card, I think, and a blue card. And so we were complicating things because we were trying to be so specific. But I think the weapons conditions were not a result of the rules of engagement. I think there's a lot of criticism about, you know, on the interior guard positions, you had magazines in the weapon, but no round in the chamber. Crucifix weapons were not loaded. I think that weapons condition was internal policy for interior guard because we were having, and this was a function of training,
right.
We were having a large number of negligent discharges. And some of the biggest violators, I think, were, you know, officers and staff NCOs with the 45s. But, why do I say that? At that time, we never took our pistols to the field. And we didn't routinely use our pistols, and the 45 was so different than other weapons. But I do think Marines were not as familiar with weapons because we didn't have numerous rounds to extend. We would go to the rifle range and we may go to the field, but this was a time, you know, we were coming off of some austerity measures then, and this is just prior to the Reagan era. And Reagan was in, and he was credited with rebuilding or rejuvenating the military. But, you know, it wasn't unusual to go to the field and do a live fire exercise with 10 rounds of ammo. Marines just weren't familiar with the weapons and talk about compressed time, they didn't have time either. And so there were negligent discharges, and I think one of the causes of the weapons conditions and reasons, it was more dangerous in the DOT headquarters to have a guard with a weapon, with a round in their magazine or in the chamber. Because negligent discharges, because rather than anything else. So So I think that the two are not directly related. I think there was two distinct things going on. One, the rules of engagement were complicated, but interior to the DOT, the weapons conditions were a function of concerns over the being more dangerous to have negligent discharges.
You know, Ron, it's interesting because, you know, at face value, when you hear how weapons are being carried, you think, oh, that's crazy. But when there's negligent discharges going on, I mean, talk about something that gets everybody's attention. Like, are you kidding me? I can recall at Camp Pendleton, officers taking, when we had to take pistols to the field, they would wrap them in plastic so they wouldn't get dirty, so they wouldn't have to clean them. And that's, I mean, I can't imagine that today, but that's the way it was. And, as you said, talk about lack of familiarity. If you don't use it, you know, we had, you know, issues with negligent discharges in Iraq and Afghanistan. Certainly weren't that many of them, but for units when they first got there, it seemed like everybody had them. And it was, a failure to adhere just to the basics of clearing your weapon. Did you really look? Did you really stick your finger in there? No. Oh, you got in a hurry. And now look where we're at. And so, and that's with the Marine Corps in Iraq and Afghanistan that shot a lot before it went. And a lot of experienced guys. And so, but you still had those issues. So the rules of engagement, explain how rules change between the white and the blue card when you weren't under attack and then when you were.
It was returning, when you could return fire, if you could identify the target, you could return fire. If you couldn't identify the target, you weren't authorized to return fire. So there was quite a lot of nuance, and the details. It actually took up two whole cards. I don't even remember all of the differences, but I do remember grilling the Marines on it and going over what-if scenarios, which was probably one of the best things that we could do, given the amount of time that we had and given the complexity of the rules of engagement.
Got an email for you. Mac, I'm listening, and Beirut, I look back on it, and I didn't understand it very well. I thought the Marines were there as peacekeepers and kind of doing their job. In reality, it looks like they got stuck into the middle of a shit sandwich. And then as we began to be more aggressive with our naval gunfire, got put in a very, very precarious situation, probably one that we really didn't understand well at the time, given the complexities of that region and our ignorance of those complexities. I would tell you to include today. I'm curious, though, did Ron think as a platoon commander that his guys were well prepared? Did he think that the rules of engagement put them at a serious disadvantage? So, Ron, at the time, did you think the rules of engagement put you at a serious disadvantage, or was it something like, because I got asked that in Iraq and Afghanistan, hey, you know, the rules of engagement, we hear your hands are tied, and my response was, our hands aren't tied. If there's Marines in trouble, we can do whatever we need to defend the Marine lives. You know, people that tell you that probably haven't really read the rules of engagement and haven't drilled into them, because if you have and you know them, you have everything in there that you need to do to be able to save Marine lives. So did you feel at the time that you guys, you know, were solid, or did you feel some trepidation relative to the rules of engagement?
Well, we felt frustrated. We felt frustrated. We understood the rules of engagement. We understood what we could and we couldn't do. But we tried to focus more on what we can do rather than what we can't do. But, you know, some of the frustrations that you would experience was things like, we were down in the center sector and we had a wall out there and there was a hole in the wall. We called it a hole in the wall gang. And you could see the individual shooting from a hole in the wall, and they would stop shooting and they would walk away. While they were shooting, you could engage, but while they walked away, you couldn't do anything. So not understanding why we had the rules of engagement that we had, it was very frustrating.
Hold on. So even after he's shooting, you positively identify him as a shooter, and then he stops shooting and walks away, you can no longer engage him?
Yes, that's how he saw it, and that's what, that was the way it was, that the situation where you were in.
That's tough. That's tough. How did your Marines must have been ripped shit about that? They couldn't have been too happy.
Well, no. They were at first, but they, you know, you start learning how to do things. And I will say, while we were not well trained in the beginning, completely well trained because of a lot of different reasons, we really got brilliant in the basics and doing things. And you know, one of the things I think you use snappers for things that you could do because you wanted precision. We were trying to avoid, the hole in the wall was, I'll tell you, the hole in the wall, gang was in a place called Hooterville, Brzezinski Barajnov, and collateral damage, there was a really high risk of collateral damage of the local civilians in a slum, basically, outside. And you couldn't afford to alienate the population there by killing kids or innocents or non-combatants.
Right.
So I could see, in hindsight, I could see why we had that. But what we did to overcome, we started getting brilliant in the basics. And that's a good example of really the classic image of an untrained army is firing a machine gun. Freehand, a free gun.
Right.
But using a TNA is much better because once you get locked on a target, when you want to fire, you're locked on and you're going to have power impact. So we would do things like set up machine gun on TNAs. Somebody would start shooting, and we would quickly dispatch them at the time and not have to wait till they walked away and waved at us and contact. So, coming up with things like range cards and being able to communicate I still remember we had the hole in the wall gang. We had the skeletal building. It was a building that was like a skeleton. We had checkpoints all over the place. We were able to communicate very laterally, using landline and radio. And we couldn't hit it from one area. We could oftentimes see it from another area and talk people on the target and being locked in on a TNA or using innovation. We were able to adapt and overcome. So I do think that, instead of focusing on what we couldn't do, we learned how to focus on what we could do and really started to have success in quieting things down.
My guest this morning, Brigadier General retired Ron Baskowski. We're talking about his time in Beirut, and he's gracious enough to give up some of his morning here to join us on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. Ron, can you talk about what your snipers were able to do then? If they had different rules of engagement, what were they? So you positively identified somebody at the hole in the wall. Could the snipers continue to engage?
Yeah, but they were in a position. The snipers had the same rules of engagement. It was a hostile act initiated against a U.S. force. But the thing about them is they were more precise and they had a much smaller footprint, and they would, we'd often put them off the side or in between positions and high positions where they could observe and have a good angle. And then with their range cards, when the hole in the wall started, they could, hit targets very precisely and for different targets throughout, Hooterville, they could, engage. So, that was how we used the snipers. They weren't in the same kind of visible position that we were. We were in position that had overhead cover. They were more in sniper hide position.
All right. Talk about the day that the barracks was destroyed. First of all, where was the barracks relative to your position at the airport? So you're in the center part of the airport.
Well, actually, we changed positions. So this is one of the things that, in hindsight, I say, how wrong could I be?
Right.
There was a policy that's rotating the company. So Alpha Company started out at the southern end of the airfield when we first got to Beirut.
Okay.
Shortly after, they rotated up to the center part of the airfield. That's when Lieutenant Losey got killed. And then, after about 2 months there, we rotated out to the Lebanese Scientific University, which was out there by the Green Line. So we took all these positions together. There was like a line that kept the, that, had like a buffer, so the Israeli Defense Force couldn't come inside a buffer zone that was set up by our position. So we were there to ensure they didn't get inside where the Muslim population was. So at the time we just couldn't understand. When we got everything perfect at our position, the battalion commander was moving us again. This is crazy. And then we got to go to another position and have to get that all fixed because the unit we just left, it hadn't done anything, and we had to fix the whole place and get that set up, and then we were going to move again. We just couldn't understand why we had to move, but in reality, I could see in hindsight the battalion commander's policy of locating companies was brilliant. You know, he wanted to stamp out this complacency. He didn't want us to be complacent and say, hey, this is perfect, this is the best position, there's everything we should know. He wanted us to see things differently. He wanted us to continually improve. He was addressing the boredom problem and all the problems that can happen when you have bored Marines with weapons.
Right.
So it was actually brilliant. But anyway, so the last time we were there, the last position we were at was the Lebanese Scientific University. So basically there was a big stretch of buildings between us, a slum called, the nickname Cooterville, between us and the airport. But we could basically generally see where the airport was, but we were separated from the airport. As the crow flies, maybe about 2.5 kilometers, but you couldn't go through the slum. You had to take a roundabout way, so it was probably about 10 kilometers to get to the airport from our station. So we were at the Lebanese Scientific University, and we were having some firefights up there and increased indirect fire there as well. In fact, we had Mike Oiler, who was our forward air controller. He was up on the roof trying to spot for aviation coming in, and he was killed. He was hit by a 7.62 round right in the head, and we were not feeling too good about ourselves. So I was sleeping in the CP on a stretcher so I could hear the radio and everything like that, about 6:30 in the morning, we heard the explosion, and so we got up and started calling the guard post, trying to get a triangulation on where that explosion was.
And now, Avon, can I stop your word? Now, can you explain? So for those of us that remember, there's a coastline. A couple of footnotes. First of all, explain the Green Line to everybody who's never heard of it.
Okay. So the Green Line is the side and road, and basically what happens is you look at Lebanon, Beirut is on a peninsula that juts out into the Mediterranean. The Green Line is a road that runs north-south from Israel all the way up to Tripoli and Sidon. So it cuts off. It goes on the eastern side of the city of Beirut, and on the right is more of a mountain. And that's on the right side, or the east of the Green Line, was the Christian, and then on the west side of the Green Line, and then further west you go into the city, was more of the Muslim population.
Right.
So it was a demarcation that had separated the Christian east from the Muslim West. So one of the things that agreement for us coming in was that we would keep the Israeli Defense Force on the Green Line or to the east, so that they wouldn't be coming close to the Palestinian families that were left behind. So that was the purpose of the Green Line.
Okay, that's how the
also known as Sidon Road.
All right, can you help us out with the geography? So you have the airport. And then you guys are at the scientific unit, Beirut Scientific University,
mm-hmm.
And that's about, you said, 10 clicks to the north.
Well, if you look at the airport in relationship to the city of Beirut,
right.
The airport is to the south of the main city.
Right.
And then as you go north, it gets more and more built up. It goes from semi-detached to semi-detached to block type construction as you get into the city.
Okay.
So the airport is along the coast, and it pretty much controlled the coastal road. And then you had a large built-up area, which I called Hooterville, right next to the airport, between the airport and the side of the road. And then the Lebanese Scientific University was along the side of the road. So you have two north-south roads, the coastal road and the side of the road. I had positions at the Scientific University,
mm-hmm.
and then some checkpoints along the way on the outside of Hooterville, and then the southern part of the airfield. You basically had a line that ran east to west, and that served as a buffer and kept the Israeli defense force from coming any further west than the Sinai Road.
All right. Now, explain to us the location of the barracks. Was it the American University, and where is that relative to you?
No, it's the Lebanese. The BLT barracks was right inside that airport.
Okay.
Itself.
Okay.
And in fact, it was the old Lebanese Aviation Administration headquarters, and it was a four-story building, and it was inside the perimeter. In fact, that was one of the things. The Lebanese Armed Forces were really supposed to be the ones providing security. Now, we had our interior security set up, and we had checkpoints, and we had entry control points. The main entry control points set up with gates and barricades and barrels and serpentine entrances. And then north of that, there were Lebanese Armed Forces at a checkpoint that would even keep anybody from coming in further. So we were pretty much that was on the interior of the airport. So it was behind the line.
Okay, all right. I was struggling with the geography. All right, so you're off to the north. You hear, I'll tell you what, I have to take one more break, and then,
sure.
And then we'll talk about that. My guest, Ron Vaskowski, we talked about the complexity, and I'll tell you what, and if you didn't have any sense of it, and you haven't read a whole lot about Beirut, and what the Marines were trying to do there, and just hearing Ron explain the different positions he was at, the fire that they came under, the rules of engagement relative to engaging, and then the complexities of how the Arab fighters saw the Marines, and maybe initially as peacekeepers and a way to keep them, keep the Israelis away from them, and kind of an insurance policy against the Israelis, and then when we start shooting naval gunfire, then we get identified with the Israelis, and the Israelis is certainly not sympathetic to Yasser Arafat and what they were doing. And then, once we get painted in that direction, I think the die is cast for what happens on October 23rd. So we'll talk about that next as we continue on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio here on the All Warrior Radio Network. Don't go away.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
One minute after 9 o'clock on a Monday, Mike McNamara with you. Check the weather here around the Marine Corps real quick. We're privileged this morning to be joined by Ron Vaskowski, retired Brigadier General, currently at Camp Lejeune, sunny in 87.
Yeah.
Sunny in 91 in 29 Palms right now. In Fallujah, 110 in the early evening there. Hawaii, dark, cloudy, 76 degrees. Camp Pendleton, cloudy, 68. Quantico, partly sunny, 87 degrees in the nation's capital, up by where Ron Vaskowski lives. Partly sunny, 89 degrees, as we continue on a Monday edition of All Marine Radio. First of all, Ron, thank you very much for taking time out of your day. I truly appreciate the visit, and I can't tell you how interesting it is, I think, for me and for our listeners to get kind of a company-level view of the incidents that surrounded the deployment of multiple battalions to Beirut, Lebanon in 1982 and 1983. So thank you very much for doing this.
Oh, sure. It's my pleasure.
So you're essentially as a company XO, Alpha Company, you're north of the airport. You're doing what a lot of XOs do, which is sleep on a cot in a CP, listen to the radio for anything that gets going with your platoons.
Yep, that's exactly what it was.
And then
every night.
A lot of XOs are smiling right now, listening to you. And so then you hear the explosion, and it goes off at what, you said approximately 6:30?
Yeah, it was around 6:30 in the morning on a Sunday. And so the first thing we tried to do is started calling out to all our guard posts, and up to that we had a moat. It was around the building had a trench around the whole thing. We called it the moat. We started trying to figure out where this explosion was so we could triangulate and try to figure out where the impacts. Then we heard all the companies around the airport trying to get the BLC headquarters as well, trying to call the battalion. And after about 5 minutes or so, hearing people calling and not saying anything back, Dave Greco, who was he might have been the FDO for the battery, the artillery battery. They're on a hill just above the battalion headquarters, and he came up and said, "Hey guys, but the BLC is gone." Nobody could figure out what he meant. BLC is gone. I mean, this building is humongous. In fact, that was where everybody wanted to go. When there was indirect fire, you wanted 4 layers of concrete over your head to protect you from the incoming artillery. And to hear that the BLC is gone, we couldn't imagine what had happened. We couldn't see it because the built-up area, Hooterville, the slums were between us and the airport. So we couldn't see that building, but we could see smoke coming up. We knew something was going on. And slowly but surely we were able to piece together what would happen. And we ended up, the MAO headquarters took over for the battalion and commanded and controlling the units. And slowly but surely we figured out what was going on. And then we were, for all intents and purposes, we were out on the extreme flank of the battalion's position in a large building, much like the headquarters, and we quickly put together that we had to do something different, and we dropped all the scaffolding that was around the adjacent building to cover all of the entryways so that nobody could come in the main entrance. So we also started the plan. We had some drive-ins with us, and we made some drive-in positions because there was a field between us and the slum, So all of a sudden we started getting the combat reporting saying that there's a hijacked Lebanese armed forces M113 packed with explosives headed our way, and so we were getting ready for the worst. So we were acting, and the good news is after the BLC headquarters was blown up, there wasn't a lot of indirect fire, and there was no direct fire anymore. It was kind of a lull in the firing. Which I don't know if it was intentional or if it was just a coincidence. But we did a quick reassessment or a quick test of the situation and figured out that things had changed, and we started redoing our position and accounting for things that could happen to us similar to what happened to the BLC headquarters.
In terms of the immediate aftermath, who took control of the fight afterwards?
Well, I think that the MAO headquarters, Colonel Garrity's headquarters, they took over, and we started reporting them. But I think the best thing that they could have done is I kind of remember his name. He explained what had happened, and we pretty much decentralized and let every company, especially where we were, know what we're on. And we were on our own, but we had to keep on reporting. And I think by explaining what was going on and letting us take steps to improve our positions to guard against further, that was probably the best thing. There was nothing we could do from where we were at the scientific university. So they let us pretty much operate and do a 360-degree security. And for a couple of days, we were pretty much on our own. We didn't go back for meetings. We didn't go back for planning. We made military decisions based on the situation we saw, and we reported up, and one of the huge things was accounting for people. So we, the DLC headquarters was placed as a transit now too, because it was, you know, that's where you would send people to go. They would, and they'd wait for transportation back to the ships. We had some people that were going back to ships for physicals, for one-offs, for packages and things like that. We had to account for every one of our people, and make sure we had it. But, you know, at that time we didn't have internet, we didn't have, modems, we couldn't transmit through this. It was all, I fell phonetically, and the numbers of our supply for Social Security. So we were accounting for people, for, you know, 200 people, by just sending them a list of our names, one at a time. And take that, you know, every company happened to be that. But that's especially because we were isolated or separated from the main defense. We're doing over POC-77s, and transmitting names one at a time, so accounting for every single person. So there's a lot of activity going on all at once, and trying to, most important, what I'm most proud of is how we quickly came and we did an estimate situation and revised our position, so we'd be prepared for this tactic.
Email question says this: Mac, I'm curious, after the bombing of the barracks, did direct fire engagements heat up for the companies? And in particular, it would appear that Ron's company, Alpha Company, being a little bit more detached, would have been an ideal target. Ron, did direct fire attacks step up while you, in the next few days?
Over time, it did pick up again. In fact, I think we were a little bit more liberal in interpreting the rules of engagement, and we were a little bit more aggressive in returning fire, even though I don't think the rules of engagement had changed considerably. It was just amplified that, you know, a moving vehicle coming at you high rate speed is hostile intent, things like that, clarification. But, yes, we did have increased fire coming in and indirect fire as well. At least at the Lebanese Scientific University, and from the edge of the town, which was interesting. In fact, that was the night we were one, probably one of the greatest things I remember was the night we withdrew from the library. Was the decision was made to pull that position, the Lebanese Scientific University position, out because it was not going to be maintained anymore. So we called our company commander back to the battalion for a meeting to make sure that they passed it. They want to pass over the radio and to talk about the plans and have every coordination, all the coordination done. So he went in for the meeting at the battalion and was headed back. And I got a message from him to start preparing to see some something range where we were going to withdraw. I knew he wanted me to withdraw. So we were preparing, and then we got in a huge firefight. In fact, it was probably one of the biggest firefights that I remember. We fired all of our 60-millimeter bore ammo to quiet the thing, quiet down this heavy gun that was fired at us from the town. And I think the thing that really stopped the firing and the firefight from happening is just a huge rainstorm came up, and it almost seemed like the guys would do their day job and then they'd come at night and fight, and then they would go to bed and go to work the next day and then come home from work and fight the next day. Well, this rainstorm quieted things down, and it was really quiet. So now the company commander, who was outside of RCP, was able to come in after the rain had stopped, after the firing had stopped, and he told us we're leaving and they're going to have, you know, 17 trucks come up here in a tow truck that we're going to move out. So we did a quick flag order, and we planned to pull out of the Lebanese Scientific University. About 1 o'clock in the morning, all the trucks arrived. We loaded up on Gunny, was absolutely determined, Kenny Butler. He was absolutely determined no U.S. property was going to be left at the Scientific University. He got everything out of there, had everything loaded, and we got in that convoy. But everything was narrow roads. The rain made everything muddy. The trucks got stuck. I was at the end of the convoy. We ended up sitting there for a long time. I'm just being seen, right? And it's getting closer and closer to daylight now. And I'm getting worried. Here we are sitting right where we had this major firefight the night before. It was with our truck trying to pull out of town. I found out that we had trucks just stuck. We pulled those out. We only had one wrecker pull out those trucks. Got moving, and so we basically had two convoys. And to get back to the airport, we had to go all the way up, right along the Green Line, then through the city of Beirut, and then down the coastal highway. It was quite an evolution, but this is where having been the French liaison officer paid off. Because I was familiar with the northern part, it was easy for me to take the second half of the convoy and catch back up. And we caught up just as we were entering back in the line. The commander already pretty much let me run that second half of the convoy. He knew, later said, you know, he knew that I had it because of my familiarity with the French sector. And I knew where to go. I was going to go into the Hippodrome if we had any problems. So it was a great feeling that night when we got inside the airport and then later back loaded onto the ship. Probably never slept better in my life as when we got back on the Harlan County, which was the LST. And even though it was bobbing and rocking, I never thought sleep could feel so good.
What was, you get back, and again, are you riding in a Jeep or are you in a truck?
At that time, I was in a truck.
Okay. So now this is not the era of the Humvee, by the way.
No, it's the
M15 one. The M15 one. That thing was good to go, too. Ron Baskowski, our guest, we're talking about his deployment with 1-8, we're talking about October 23rd and thereabouts during that deployment. Ron, do you remember seeing the barracks when you got back,
yeah.
And what was that like? What was that like?
That's everybody. When we came into the airport, everybody wanted to see the barracks, because our last memory of it was, again, a four-story building. It was huge. It was probably about a 150-seat square building, four stories high with a huge atrium in it. And so we were all trying to imagine how could the DOT be gone. So when we pulled into the airport at about 7:30 in the morning, coming out of that all-night convoy from hell, everybody's looking out trying to see it. It was just a flattened mess. You just couldn't believe it. But, it was just flat. Most of the bodies had been recovered by then. This was now in November. I think it might have been November 12th when we moved out. I remember doing the birthday, my uncle's birthday, at the scientific university. And that was on the 10th. So this may have been a couple days after the my uncle's birthday. But everybody's looking and we're just in awe that this huge building that was once huge, that everybody felt safe in, was just a pile of rubble.
The lessons learned from that deployment, obviously one that continues to be discussed and Marines study it in terms of peacekeeping missions and the complexities of a region. We don't have a whole lot of say at our level. But when you think about the lessons that you learned and from that deployment, what were they?
Well, I think first lesson I would learn was, you know, training is absolutely important. I think what Rommel might have said, the best form of welfare is first-class training, and I think that's absolutely essential. Brilliance in the basics. We got there. We did get to the brilliance in the basics after we were on the ground for a while and just from operating every day, but we should have deployed with that brilliance in the basics. I mentioned that we had about 40 NCOs and Lance Corporal squad leaders go to squad leader school. That paid huge dividends because we could now communicate. We all had an understanding of what a standard was for a range guard. We understood how it was used. We were able to talk, cross-talk up and down because of all our squad leaders knew what to do because they had been to squad leader school and they knew what was expected with range cards and fire plan sketches and why it's not just going through the motions, it's actually a tool that you use to execute your mission. But I think that was a lesson that was reinforced. The more education that you can give Marines and get more training that you can do, the better off you are going to be when you're trying to do a complex mission. I think mission analysis is a key thing. I do think that our mission changed, and we changed the nature of our mission as time went on. But we didn't change enough things. We didn't have an understanding of the the reason why. You know, what do we knew what we were supposed to do, support the fire security, fire department, provide security for and support the government of Lebanon. But we didn't have an understanding of the first and second order effects that we were having by indirect fire. But incidentally, it wasn't just returning indirect fire that caused us to be perceived as a belligerent. You know, we were in Lebanon, there was the Lebanese armed forces. They were seen largely as a proxy of the Christian militia. And they were one and the same. And then when we supported them with indirect fire, not that we're supporting ourselves, but they were really supporting the Lebanese armed forces. Right. When we resupplied them and when we gave them intelligence, that's when I think we became, it clear. So up and down the chain of command, I think that even external to in theater or in country, decisions were being made not based on a full appreciation of the second and third order effects of these actions. But I think mission analysis and understanding the intent or purpose and what you're trying, the overall mission, what you're trying to accomplish is absolutely important. I learned some tactical lessons that I think Leon helped me out as a company commander in Desert Storm and then later on as an advisor in OIS. And that's the imagination is a powerful force. And guys can really get spooked by what they think is going to happen. When we went to Lebanon, we were excited, and everybody was nervous about everything, because even though it was a peacekeeping mission, it was, you know, we just saw thousands of people killed, and it was combat, and there were not a whole lot of combat vets in the battalion at the time. Nobody really knew what to expect. Even in my own case, when I told you I flew into from Cyprus on a CH-53, and I landed at the airport, and I was expecting that I'd have to get out of the helicopter like it was a hot LZ. And it couldn't be any further from the truth. When I landed, I felt like I was almost landing in an admin environment, and somebody's going to hand me up my top or something like that. It was unbelievable. But your mind will play tricks on you because you imagine something bad can happen any minute, and you have no idea. So talking to vets and understanding what it can be like is a huge thing, and learning from others' experiences. So as we became more familiar with the environment and gained confidence, it was really exciting. We started building, we discussed about textbook examples. We built fighting positions that had overhead cover and that had machine gun positions inside the building when we were at the library at the Scientific University. And we could start anticipating close on. We were doing flashbang techniques. I remember he's now Lieutenant General Mark Balakis. He was our artillery FO. I remember sitting in a fighting position with him looking up the east-west valley up into the Chute Mountains. And we were doing flashbang. He introduced me to the OS fan. And the team, in-sport observer team, had a small bunch. We were doing flashbang, and we were coming up with six-digit grids that later on, when the counter-border radar would kick in, it would give us a 10-digit grid, which basically was the same as the six-digit grid that we were able to come up with in you know, quite a short amount of time, within 30 seconds of doing the flashbang method. So the more familiar we became, the more confidence we had, and the more exciting. Nobody really cared about the showing. Now it became how are we going to counter this, and how are we going to do that? And Marines had tremendous confidence as the time went on. But we didn't go in with that confidence. I think understanding or having training that puts you through some of the stresses gives you the confidence in your skills and allows you to operate. All of those are enough lessons. I certainly think that the mind is a very, very powerful force. You can talk yourself out of things very quickly.
No, you know, and Ron, you and I both know as the Marine Corps, as we went to Iraq and Afghanistan, as we got more and more experience, you know, you started hearing things commonplace. Phrases like, Well, you said you used one, Brilliance in the Basic. I remember first started saying Slow is Pro, and you used to hear that a lot, just about being steady, being measured. And then, you know, just as you, and the problem was back then that, you know, you guys were the only, one of the few battalions that, you know, got that experience. We had a lot of guys. I mean, you were trained by Vietnam veterans. I was trained at the basic school. You know, most of your peers, you were a young guy then, but the guys who that you were snapping in with, most of those guys were, you know, had some experience as lieutenants in Vietnam. And so it was, you know, but there was just not that much of that going around anymore. And so I agree with you. That experience, that confidence that comes with operating, knowing you can do it, and having been shot at, and having come back from it, and having improvised, having looked hard at it, there's nothing like that. And, you know, we do our best that we can in peacetime, but in retrospect, in looking back at that, it seemed like we were such a naive, you know, we were so different relative to operating in a joint environment. We were so different relative to the way we do intelligence and what you guys had to deal with over there. And, you know, it almost seems like we were babes in the woods relative to those kind of missions, the complexities that come with them, and our it seems like our lack of understanding of the subtleties that we certainly learned a better appreciation of subsequent to Beirut.
Yeah, I would agree. I hope we learned Friedman writes the Beirut to Jerusalem. He does a pretty good job explaining how we were exactly what you were talking about. We were innocents too, that led to the slaughter. We didn't know what we were doing as much, and we didn't know that what we were doing was going to lead to second and third order effects. But it was exactly played, and it was played by people that that's their culture for thousands of years. It's how people survive. So through the Byzantine type politics and power and alliances, we were just caught in a tangle. We came for a noble purpose, I believe. When you think about the loss of life, it just tragic, and it's sad. If we don't learn from it, I think we have learned from it. It would be even more tragic.
Ron, let me ask you. Let's I think that's the phrase they use on the memorial at Camp Johnson, isn't it? They came in peace. If I'm not mistaken, I think that's written on the memorial there. I want to switch gears and ask you about some current day Marine Corps issues.
Okay.
First of all, gender integration. Your thoughts on that?
Well, gender integration, it's a tough one. But I always learned, and I used to say, I would think, you have to give your best military advice. And then whatever comes out, you have to execute as if, whether it's your, what your advice was, whether your advice is taken or not, you have to pull out with a full 30-inch stuff and execute as if it was your own. I think the Marine Corps leadership was very wise. They gave the best military advice to civilian leadership, and they made a decision. And now it's the time to carry out the decision as if it was our own. But I think was really smart, and we got some really smart leaders in the Marine Corps. They commissioned a study. They did a very hard they did very well at doing a hard job of delivering an unpopular message to leaders. But they did it, and they now know a lot of the issues that they have to overcome and reasons why, what they have to do, or special needs that they have to make, or rate things that they have to do different with a fully integrated force. And I think there's many pundits that are critical, the Marine Corps senior leaders or the Department senior leaders sold out. They're worried about their own careers. They copped out on this one. I think that those critics should just, until they walk in the shoes of our senior leaders, they should just keep quiet because they don't know what they're talking about. The gender integration is not going to be the end of the Marine Corps. Would it be easier if we had it? Sure. There would be less logistics you have to do. There would be less cultural things you have to do. It's a change. Change is always hard. But the Marine Corps will survive, and it will figure out how to operate with an integrated, gender-integrated force that effectively operate, not just operate. And the way we're going to figure it out is that the leaders, that the senior leaders, that are now solving the next strategic problems, like force levels in Afghanistan, keeping those levels high enough so we don't have to go back in 10 years from now. While they're solving the bigger strategic problems, now it's time for the tactical leaders to step up. They know what goes on. They now know what has to be done differently, and they have to figure out how we're going to do it so that the senior leaders can solve the bigger problems, the next big problems that are going to come up, and keep the Marine Corps and the U.S. And Department of Defense strong for the future. So can it be done? Yeah, it can be done. Am I confident? Yes, I'm absolutely confident. This is not the first time the Marine Corps has had to do something, or the military has had to do something that would be hard to do. We'll figure out how to do it, and we'll do it well, just as if it was our own idea. But I'm confident it's going to work out somehow, but it's doing it because of the culture of the Marine Corps. When we're told to do what we're told to do, we're going to do it. We're going to do it better than anybody else.
Right. Let me ask another hard question about it. For instance, and I agree with you. Now, let me ask you the same question. Let's just suppose, for the sake of discussion, that zero or very few women get through the infantry officer course, and let's just suppose that very, very small numbers of women get into the infantry MOS. And Congress looks at the Marine Corps and says, hey, you know what? Your standards need to come more in line with the Army, or you need to lower your standards because we don't see this. Is there, because I think most Marines feel that, hey, I'm okay with this as long as the standard doesn't change. Do you see an issue with the standard? Is that a problem for you if we are directed to change our standards?
But I think if the standard causes you not to be able to accomplish the mission or not to be able to operate, then I think that certainly is wrong. I want to be honest. We're told to do something. Let's be honest with what we can't do and what we can't live out and with what we don't want to live without. Or there's a difference between can't and not want to. I've always been physically fit and everything like that. I think in my whole 32 years in the Marine Corps, I've only been to 300, maybe three or four times. But I remember as a battalion commander, we had to provide so many people. The reconnaissance was broken. We needed to provide candidates to recon for recon indoc. And we wanted to do it. We were told to do it. We wanted to do it. But everybody we would give, they were getting rejected during the recon screening. And I wanted to find out as the battalion commander at that time. I wanted to find out what was going on. So I took I volunteered myself to do the recon screening. Okay, and I'll be honest with you, I did great on the run. I did great on the pass mark. I did all of that stuff. But on my second running on the obstacle course, I hit my chest on one of the beams, and I took the wind out of myself, and I was hurting. I didn't clear that obstacle. So I would have been withheld from serving in recon, even though I could run a sub-3 hour marathon, a 300 GFP. I would have been excluded from the being accepted for reconnaissance because I failed to hit the vaccination. If we make a bar that it doesn't accurately reflect the standards that we need, then I think we need to be honest as well. And I'm absolutely confident the Marine Corps will. Other positions in the infantry that you don't have to be, Johnny Weiss Mueller, sure. There's lots of positions. You always found a place for the guy that couldn't quite do all the pull-ups or that couldn't do it. What I'm concerned about is if you have if you have 10% that couldn't meet the standard before, that you're finding jobs for them as clerk or whatever, they're doing an essential thing for you, a job for you. If you start, having now at 20% or 30%, maybe that could cause it. But that's the judgment call that the league is going to have to decide and make a determination on. But I don't think it's going to get to that point. I think the Marine Corps is showing good faith. They've laid out in the study, what it takes for the temple, what is required, and they'll figure out how to do it and how to integrate and where it makes sense and where it doesn't make sense and carry off the spirit of the intent. And I don't think it's going to come to the civilian leadership saying, you're not doing what I told you.
Interesting. Okay. It's an interesting issue. And I hope you're right, and I hope the politics don't get into it, because I think the Marine Corps has done what's right. I think the Ground Combat Integration Task Force was the right thing to do. I think the data that they put out served to illustrate some of the challenges that trainers and schools will face, as well as leaders in the Fleet Marine Force. So it's an interesting issue. It, at its root, is the lifeblood of the Marine Corps, I think, which is our infantry organizations and making sure that they are as tough and as formidable, and remain that way for the future, because when they're not, that means more people are going to pay with their lives. And so it's an important issue. But you know what, Ron, I agree with you. I think that the Marine Corps has acquitted itself very well in terms of being brutally honest and not simply rolling over and saying, yes, sir, 3 bags full. That we tried to articulate the difficulties of the profession and what we need, at the same time saying, going about it smartly. I think the Commandant's initiative to create standards for all the MOSs that didn't exist previous to that is a statement to that. And he's of the mind that we'll have higher quality infantrymen across the board. And his school directors have told him as much. So interesting issue that bears out all the things that you said.
Okay.
Ron, first of all, I want to thank you for, again, taking a couple hours out of your morning to talk to us about your career and B, your thoughts on your deployment in 1983 to Beirut and the challenges that you guys faced over there. So thank you very much for coming on this morning, and I hope you don't mind that from time to time I bother you and bring you back on and we talk about things Marine Corps.
No, my pleasure. Have you got time for one more lesson learned?
No, absolutely.
Okay, well, listen, in between when you took breaks, I heard your announcements. I think it's a great message that you were saying about reaching out and support networks. I never considered myself to be combat stressed or to have PTSD, but I did notice the first Christmas, we got back just before Christmas from our Beirut deployment. And I remember being a troop service in Charleston, South Carolina, and just having a tremendous sadness fall over me. And it really did affect me. And it was understandable. We had just gotten back from deployment. It was really so, but I didn't think anything of it. And then when I went to Quantico, my wife and I would go up to Arlington Cemetery either on the 23rd of October or just before or after because of my work schedule. And we'd put flowers on graves. One of my friends, John Wood, the Naval Academy alumni with me, we were in basic school together. We'd go. But I always noticed I'd get tense and irritable, and over time I just avoided situations that made me irritable and uncomfortable. And then throughout my career, though, I had to speak at birthday balls and at conferences and at meetings and things like that. And whenever I started talking about Beirut and then later on about the sacrificing or honoring the gone book, I would just notice that my voice would begin to waver.
Right.
And it was starting to make me, I would get that deep feeling of sadness again. But, so I just avoided those situations whenever possible. But when it came time to retire, I knew I was going to have to get up and make a speech. And the last thing I wanted to do was break down, emotionally during a farewell speech. So I went to the doc and I said, "Hey doc, give me a pill just to calm me down when I get a region." The doc was in Tebe and she was fantastic. She didn't just give me a pill. She did give me a pill eventually, but did a lot of counseling and understanding and other things with me, and it instantly had success. And in just 2 months of my retirement, I felt great. I felt wonderful. I just actually thought everything was good, and I it didn't break down at all. But I retired, and I stopped taking my medication, which in the end I think was a mistake, because about a year later I went to Arlington Cemetery for the 30th ceremony commemorating the 30th anniversary of the bombing, and that brought it to Don Woolett's gravesite. When I arrived at the cemetery, my throat just closed up. I couldn't talk. In fact, there are a couple people that came instantly that tried to help me out, and the guy at the desk was trying to help me out, and I couldn't talk. I had to write down Don's name on a piece of paper just to communicate with the attendant. And I knew immediately I still needed help with the feeling of some kind of painful memory. I never associated with a painful memory with the week. I never really, it was just a feeling of sadness. But when I look back, I really feel foolish that I hadn't sought help for 30 years to get help for the film. When I took the pills, when I talked to the doctor at K-Bay, there was an immediate relief. And I recognized that all the time that I spent avoiding my problem, the time that I didn't have to be miserable, and I was so happy. So I started taking my medication again. And I'm going to get off of it again in the near future. But I'm not going to go cold turkey like I did last time because there's no bad side effects. But there's somebody there to help. I'm just struck by that there are so many organizations and so much support available that if people feel it, if people understand, you know, they're not sure about whether help is needed or if it could help, I recommend if there's any doubt whatsoever, they just go talk to somebody. You don't have to talk to them. They're not really a big deal. It's just seek some help with any one of these organizations, and they're pretty good. They'll listen to you, which sometimes is all that it takes. And if it's something more serious, this is something that people are aware of. There's no stigma with it. I think there's more of a stigma right now that I was afraid to go for all those years. I kicked myself for not having done earlier. I think about the times, all the different things that I could have done and not feel as bad as I did. It would have been wonderful. It wasn't debilitating, but it was a gnawing angst it feels like a weight is off my shoulders now. So I applaud what you're doing. I applaud that the message of your All Marine Radio and what you're trying to do, the advertisements that you have between links, and I hope that the listeners take advantage of all the great organizations that are here to help. So thanks very much for letting me give that last lesson.
No, I apologize for not asking you, Ron. You know, but Ron, the culture that you grew up in the Marine Corps, you straddled two worlds in terms of what the Marine Corps was and then what it's become in terms of mental health. Nobody went to mental health. You know, when I was, I was a few years behind you, but who would go to mental health? Right? I mean, we joined the Marine Corps that was a drinking, fighting organization, and then I think I'd been on active duty for a couple years when it's like, what do you mean they're going to yank you out of your car at the gate and write you up for being drunk? Like, why aren't they just going to give you a ride home? Well, I mean, that's the way we used to do it. And, Blackjack, I mean, you hear his talks now about alcoholism in the Marine Corps and whatnot. I mean, and it blows your mind. But that was the norm. And then into that, you're going to go. And these are Vietnam guys. I mean, they fought a war. 58,000 guys got killed. I mean, there's no shit on, and they didn't go to mental health, so we're going to go to mental health. So, I mean, and now after, coming back from Iraq and Afghanistan and then the different iterations, and now we just take it like, yeah, you got to repair your body in the gym. You got to go repair your mind. If it needs to be repaired, you got to go do that. You got to go talk to a therapist, and you might have to be medicated for a period of time so you can get to a better place. But it's now so much of a matter of fact, the biggest problem I see is people get off active duty and they try to plug into the VA and they're unsuccessful and they get frustrated and then they just kind of drift away. And your message is, don't drift away. There's a lot of organizations, you know, out there. Improvise, adapt, and overcome, but don't quit.
Absolutely.
Interesting. You know, I got great advice. I had a helicopter crash into my company's assembly area in 1993, up in Iron Palms, and everybody in the helicopter, you know, killed, but not before you tried to save them and you went through that terrible, you know, experience of trying as hard as you can to help somebody live, them trying to live, and none of it working out. Mike Gunny looked at me and said, told me that this came from Vietnam, this piece of advice came from Vietnam, and I was fortunate that he was there. He looked at me and he said, you know you're never going to get over this. And I said, what the hell does that mean? He said, what that means is, he said, that comes from Vietnam. He said, and what that means is that it's going to bother you, and it's okay. I mean, it was such good advice for me to hear that whenever it bothered me, I didn't feel like I was a damaged person. I just felt like it was normal because of what that event had done to me and, you know, and trying to save people and watching them die and how that affects you. And I would give that advice to guys in Iraq and Afghanistan. And you almost see like this, like, oh, you know, like I'm not screwed up. Like this is normal for me now. But it's such a hard thing to navigate, and I call it my menstrual cycle. Some days I'll go to, you know, I've been to Arlington and had the exact same experience. I can't talk. I can feel the tears, you know, welling up in my eyes. And it's like, wait a minute, I was just thinking about this the other day and didn't have this reaction. Like, what is going on with me today? And it's tough to get your hands around. You know, I'll tell you, sir, I mean, thank you very much for saying all that. And do you still see somebody now? Do you still go to counseling?
No, I don't. I don't feel like I need to. It was pretty easy. But you know, I can now talk about things that I would just avoid talking about. And I think that's a big thing. It's going there at first gave me enough that I could get over to the point where I could talk about stuff. And you need to find, I think, you need to find someone that you can talk to that maybe has experienced the same kind of thing that you're comfortable talking to. You don't have to talk the whole world about it. But before I couldn't even talk about it, I would just avoid it. And holding it in, absolutely, I think holding it in is what made it worse. It just sort of it compounded itself over time.
All right. Well, again, Ron, thank you very much for coming on this morning, and certainly appreciate your candor and your time, and we'll do this again in the not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Okay, Mike, thanks for what you do.
You bet. That is Brigadier General retired Ron Vasikowski. Again, I met him in 1984. I was a second lieutenant, and he built, as I told the story, but he built the first terrain model I'd ever seen. And I've crossed paths with him since. And has always taken time for me, always had a kind word for me, and just a great guy, and appreciate him sharing not only his thoughts about Free Root, but his thoughts about mental health as well. More of All Marine Radio. Sarah Rudder's going to join us next. Don't go away.